Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Listen. Just touching on some real issues right here tonight.
That's all.
Y'all to observe the excellence here. BX providing the sonics, my man, Minnesota. I'm letting the beat ride out because it's a part that I like when it come up, you know what I'm saying? I take this time to say what's up to my family. You hear that? You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
Just observe the excellence of that. That's many.
Then. Hey, back. Fall back.
With the guitars. It's hip-hop music. It's good enough to speak for itself. And you gotta do right by it. Minnesota.
You know black people in Minnesota?
We mentioned the knife attack in St. Cloud, Minnesota this weekend. The details again. 9 people were stabbed at a shopping mall there before the attacker was fatally shot by an off-duty police officer. The suspect appears to have been part of the local Somali-American community. Saud Ulat is a Somali-American activist who lives in St. Cloud. He says some members of his community fear a backlash against them, especially because tensions have been high in St. Cloud for a while.
Last year, it was 2015 and 14 when children walk out of school after being called your ISIS, and that was something that made to the headlines. And the incident of yesterday, you know, broke hearts of the families. Even the local madrasas did not open yesterday, and children did not go to school because families feel scared about the repercussions of what has been happening.
And when you say these madrasas were closed yesterday, so these are kind of schools for kids on the weekend, Sunday schools almost.
Yeah, exactly. Like kind of family tuxis where children can learn, you know, Quran and discipline like that. And kind of, so when I called the teacher yesterday, can I bring our kids? He said no, because of we don't want children to get hurt. So we call off for the tuxi, he told me yesterday.
So there was concern that if kids from this community of Somali Americans went outside, they might be attacked on their way to Sunday school?
Yeah, that's why the school officials call off for the day, because the incident happened just the night. So they said, no, we can't have the children today.
So today, Monday, what are the concerns of the Somali American community there in St. Cloud?
You know, today, the reactions and people talking about, like, when you go to coffee shops, I go to the college, St. Cloud Technical and Community College, you know, people are talking about this issue. What are the repercussions? What can we say? You know, a friend of mine who was driving along to the Walmart shopping, he said someone turned down his window and he gave me a finger. I just ignore it. So, you know, people are scared now. And, you know, I work as an interpreter sometimes because most people do not speak English. So people tell me what you hear, what's going on. So it's really, really a scary moment for the Somali community, because St. Cloud is particularly known for, you know, high tensions of the host community and the refugees here. People think, oh my God, without nothing happening, we've been feeling scared, we've been called names. You know, now incident happening, what will happen? So there's a high tensions here, and people, you know, wanted to know more information.
Saud, what about your own activism? Because whenever these attacks happen, whenever you have kids being called ISIS, you've got to get out and you've got to talk to people. Does it ever get fatiguing because you have to go through the usual repercussions and retaliation, how it all kind of unpacks? Do you feel
exactly.
People are listening to you?
Yeah, people are listening, because like when I said, okay, I work as a refugee advocate and I want more refugees to come to Minnesota. People think like they don't take me serious, and maybe most people try to get mad and saying that, oh, no, we have problems here, so why you wanted to bring a lot of more refugees here? I told them, hey, I was a refugee for 21 years, and I'm here in Minnesota. I love Minnesota. It's my state. I work here. I go for school here. So what I'm trying to say is that if one person commit a crime, of if one person tried to go to Syria to fight with ISIS, he does not represent Islam. He does not represent all the community. We have nurses who are working at the hospital. We have police officers. Those people have been refugees for a long time. So, like, I'm using my activism to change people's perception about refugees, not only Somalis, but any refugee who come to the United States, especially in Minnesota. So people are listening now when they see you or listen your interview or they talk to you. Five people, four, maybe listen to you and change their perception. But that needs to be something that we can do consistently. We never give up. So eventually we may reach the goal that people see us as like other fellow Americans, but not a threat or someone who wanted to kill you or to hurt you.
Somali American activist Sud Ulat lives in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Sparking debate tonight, a Belmont University student here in Nashville is kicked out of school over a racist post on social media.
Well, the freshman student posted a rant during the Philadelphia Eagles Monday night football game using Snapchat. Fox 17's Matt Alvarez joining us live from Belmont with the fallout right now. Matt.
Scott and Stacy, Belmont University took swift action soon after the social media post went viral.
I'm ashamed that, you know, someone I go to school with would say that.
During last night's national anthem in Chicago, three Philadelphia Eagle football players raised their fists in the air. And according to a viewer, a Belmont University freshman posted a Snapchat similar to this of the players that said, quote, piece of expletive, expletive. Every one of them needs a damn bullet in their head. If you don't like this country, get the hell out. Soon after the post went viral, Belmont began an investigation, quote, we reject comments rooted in racism or bigotry. This is not free speech. This is hate speech. The university is investigating and will take immediate action.
I don't know where he's from, but coming and doing something like that at a Christian university of all places is really just surprising and wrong.
Hours later, a Belmont spokesperson said after investigating the racist social media post, the person involved is no longer a student at Belmont, and that the university is inclusive and diverse.
It was a pretty aggressive thing to say, and that was wrong. I agree with that. Definitely a wrong thing to say, you know, but being expelled is, I think, a little bit of an overreaction.
I think more people need to be aware about what's the racism that's going on. Instead of expelling is good, but also, like, just be taught about the bigotry that goes on and, I don't know, have some type of seminar or class or something that just shows about racist, homophobic, anything.
And a representative from the Black Student Association says, quote, we'd like to thank Belmont University for its timely response to the recent incident of hate speech issued by a member of our community. It is reassuring to know that racial violence cannot and will not be tolerated on our campus, end quote. Now, it's important to point out that the student has not been expelled, but instead kicked out of school, which means this student can appeal the university's decision. Reporting live, Matt Alvarez, Fox 17 News.
We shine because they hate us, floss because they the greatest. We trying to buy back our 40 acres. And for that paper, look how low we are stooped. Even when I'm in my Benz, I'm still a nigga.
Man is behind bars tonight after Coweta County deputies say that the 72-year-old yelled racial slurs and pointed a gun at a construction crew and threatened to kill them. Fox News' Nathalie Pozo spoke with the worker who recorded it all. She joins us now live tonight from the Coweta County Sheriff's Office. Nathalie?
Well, Tom, the construction worker I spoke with, Nelson King, tells me while it was an extremely frustrating situation for all of them, they remained calm. Now, Nelson tells me that the 72-year-old man not only took out a gun once, but twice, and it was that second time that prompted him to record it. He says it's a good thing he did, because when police showed up, they couldn't find the gun in the car, but he had the evidence. According to a report from the Coweta County Sheriff's Office, 72-year-old Harold Bishop yelled racial slurs and pointed a gun at a group of construction workers Thursday morning.
He pulled up on us and he like, get the N-word off the road. Nigga. I live here. I kill you, N-word.
Nelson King is one of those workers and says Bishop was aggravated because he wanted to get home, but Standing Rock Road near Brown's Crossing was closed for construction. King says when he saw Bishop take out a gun, he started recording.
Basically just get it all on film and take to the authority.
King says while he documented the incident, a co-worker called 911. According to the report from the sheriff's office, Bishop left in his white Ford Explorer but then returned to the scene. The reporting deputy says when they arrived, he saw Bishop toss out a beer from his window. The deputy said he could smell alcohol on Bishop, but they did not find a gun in his car. That's when King says he took out the proof.
I showed the police the video, and they seen the gun. When he pointed it at us, they was like, oh, he got to go.
Bishop is charged with 5 counts of aggravated assault with a firearm, weapon pointing a gun at another, terroristic threats, DUI, and probation violation.
You never know what to expect from these people nowadays, so.
And Bishop remains behind bars at the Coweta County Jail on no bond. His next court appearance is scheduled for Thursday. Reporting live tonight in Coweta County, Nathalie Pozo, Fox 5 News.
All right, Nathalie, thanks.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. With shows in New York, London, France, and Berlin under his belt, Kelly Walker has made a name for himself in the U.S. and international art world. The Georgia-born artist opened his first solo American Museum exhibition, Direct Drive, this month at the Contemporary Art Museum, but not without controversy. As St. Louis Public Radio's Jenny Simone reports, some are upset about the white artist's use of black bodies.
Kelly Walker is not the kind of person who commands a room. I meet him during the installation of his exhibition, Direct Drive, and when we shake hands, I'm struck by how tall he is and the contrast to his understated dress and soft-spoken tone. Around us hang floor-to-ceiling screen prints, brick paintings, and a full-size copy of one of the museum's walls. As an artist, he aims to comment on pop culture, propaganda, technology, and history.
No, I'm not talking about history you learned in school. My work kind of deals everything with like the rise of modernism and starting kind of close to, back to the Industrial Revolution and through sort of the beginning of the digital age.
Direct Drive brings in works from Walker's past shows, most notably Black Star Press and Schema. Both use images of black figures, one of the model and rapper Trina, scantily clad on the cover of King magazine coated in scans of smeared toothpaste. The other uses a 1963 image of Birmingham police and dogs attacking a civil rights movement protester. The print is splattered with different shades of chocolate. Both works have garnered Walker a reputation for commenting on race in America. It's something Jeffrey Uslip has had in the works for the past 3 years, since he was appointed CAM's chief curator.
He is the one contemporary artist of our generation that is thinking through history, race, identity, and their lasting, evolving, and rotating implications.
Unsurprisingly, Walker's critics disagree.
He uses images of us being attacked and brutalized. He uses images of black women being over-sexualized, and he can't explain why.
That's Damon Davis, local interdisciplinary artist. He attended Walker's artist talk on the opening day of the exhibit and spoke during the Q&A session. A live stream of that talk has since been removed from CAM's Facebook, but I spoke with Davis afterward.
He rambled on and on about technology and color theory and just a bunch of surface-level rhetoric. And at the end of the day, he's using the images of us as controversy. the same way white people do have been doing since the beginning of time. He is the epitome of white privilege. He does what he wants with the images of black people, and he doesn't have to be accountable to anybody. And he didn't expect anyone to walk in and ask him any real questions.
Davis has also taken to Facebook calling for a boycott of the exhibit, asking Cam to take down the work and issue an apology to the black community. Walker has since returned home to New York, but I asked him at the installation about past racial critiques of his work and why, as a white man, he uses black bodies as central figures.
The race issue? I think I deal with the body more so than race, and the body both being the mechanical or the machine, like the computer or the record player, as well as the body being an organic, material-based being.
This exhibit is not the first time audiences have spoken up about Walker's use of, quote, black images, whether it's pictures of celebrities like Whitney Houston or big moments in black history. It's a charge Walker responds to this way.
No one can answer the question who has and who doesn't have the right to whatever images.
Perhaps Cam anticipated the strong response to Direct Drive. They're co-hosting a panel on Thursday with Critical Mass for the Arts on art and the black body. You can see the show through December. I'm Jenny Simone, St. Louis Public Radio.
We begin finding our man. We found them sometimes without their skin, and sometimes much, much worse. El que hace trofeos de los hombres means the demon who makes trophies of man.
The U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York is charging three correctional officers or prison guards for their brutality against an inmate. Apparently, these prison guards not only beat this inmate, but they also refused to give him the medical attention that he needed. Now, the prisoner in question is Kevin Moore. And according to reports, they were torturing the inmate. They were using his hair as decorations. And they also faked their own injuries to justify the assault against him. Now, he was put into a prison, and he was only supposed to be there for one night before they moved him to Rikers. And what ended up happening was they wanted to put him in a special portion of the prison that's reserved for those who have mental issues, right? And he doesn't have mental issues. So he had mentioned that he was very much concerned about them putting him in a specialized cell block. And he said that he didn't want to be portrayed as a monster. Well, after that happened, George Santiago Jr., Carson Morris, and Kathy Scott, these are the prison guards, beat the hell out of him, okay? A wide conspiracy of unprovoked torture and cover-up among downstate correctional officers at the expense of Moore, who is black. Okay, so those are the charges that they're facing. Moore, who's the inmate, worried that the Department of Corrections might change his health records to reflect his stay in the specialized cell block. He didn't want his record to portray him as a monster, he allegedly told officers. That's when several officers allegedly grabbed him while Morris began beating him with his fists and baton. Now, apparently one of them also told him, who's the monster now, as they're beating him. For minutes on end, the officers allegedly punched and kicked him, first in the head, then in the groin, after his pants slipped down. After Moore was moved from the pool of his own blood, Santiago, the prison guard, allegedly returned to the scene to collect some of his dreadlocks, which had been ripped out. Santiago wanted them as a trophy to decorate his motorcycle.
The demon who made trophies of man.
As a result of this attack, the inmate had serious injuries, life-threatening injuries. He was hospitalized for 17 days. He had five fractured ribs, a collapsed lung, facial fractures in multiple places, severe contusions to the back, hand, leg, and foot.
So it takes only the slightest little thing to set them off.
Yeah.
Because he didn't even call them monsters. He said, I don't want to seem like a monster.
Yeah.
And so they're like, oh, okay, great. You want to see monsters. We'll show you monsters.
Mm-hmm.
What in the world? Why? What? He didn't even say anything about them. And then they, to me, like the facial fractures and the collapsed lung, those were the ones that really got to me. Because
he
obviously could have easily died from the collapsed lung. They didn't give him medical treatment for a long time afterwards, thereby increasing the chance of him dying. Mm-hmm. He's lucky he didn't die. And they beat his face so bad, they fractured different parts of his face. And all because what? I guess they're sadistic. Because this wasn't even like you didn't follow orders. This wasn't you disrespect. This was nothing. And these guys have a history of doing this over and over. And it drives me crazy every time we do one of these stories that we don't teach the Stanford Prison Experiment to every, you know, holding facility in America, to every jail, every prison, every warden, every guard. Because the Stanford Prison Experiment shows that we as human beings, if you put us into a prison situation, the guards will become sadistic, mm-hmm. and they will become super aggressive against the prisoners. The prisoners will internalize that they did something wrong. And that was Stanford students who had done nothing wrong, and they were told that they had done nothing wrong. You put them in, within 2 days, they became monsters.
Yeah.
And so this is what happens all across the country, all the time, yet we never account for it. And every time we're like, wow, no. And a lot of people will say, no, 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 he must have deserved it somehow.
Yeah.
But luckily, in this case, at least there's justice, and the prosecutors are going after these guys.
The prosecutors are going after them. I don't know if there's going to end up being justice. I don't know how this is all going to play out, right? What I do know is that public opinion regarding inmates is that they're throwaways of society that deserve whatever they get to them, right? They get treated like slaves, where they literally have to do labor and get no money for it. And the reason why corporations do that is because, hey, we can outsource jobs to other countries, or we can insource jobs in prisons and not have to pay workers a decent wage so they can live. So there's that component of it. And then there's the component of prison guards beating the shit out of inmates. There's the component of prisoners getting raped repeatedly on a regular basis, and nothing's done about that. Congress refuses to even address that issue or even vote on that issue. And so, you know, we have these discussions about America and how great this country is and how patriotic we all need to be. No, I'm not patriotic. I'm not proud of my country. I see stuff like this, and it goes against the Constitution. It goes against what this country was supposed to be founded on. This is embarrassing, okay? Beating a man for saying that he's concerned about being put in a specialized cell block that he's not supposed to be in is unacceptable behavior, to say the least. And these prison guards had been accused of similar behavior several times before. This wasn't a one-time thing, okay? These people are violent, and I don't want to talk about whether or not they should get fired from their jobs. I want them in prison, okay? Any other human being beating the shit out of someone else like this would go to prison for a long time. But these prison guards get to do whatever the fuck they want, right? Because it's just a black prisoner. Who gives a shit about him?
Yeah. Now, in this case, it's not just the fine. They are charged with crimes. So they might wind up in prison. Then they're probably going to want more humane treatment of prisoners. And by the way, that happens all the time. Sometimes Republicans get caught doing bribery. Democrats get caught too. But Democrats already wanted prison reform, generally speaking. But the Republicans will come out and go, did you know how bad it is inside prisons?
They're clowns.
Yeah, no shit, Sherlock. Yes, we did. You were the one ignoring that. And they usually go to low security prisons, and even then they're freaked out by it. They don't go to these kind of prisons.
Yeah.
And so, again, no ability to empathize until it happens to them.
Yeah. And by the way, one final component of this story is that they wanted to justify what they had done to this inmate, and so they faked injuries in order to justify it. They said that he had attacked them, which is why they beat him to a pulp, right? So to create the appearance of a struggle, Santiago allegedly struck another corrections officer with his baton while Morris applied friction to the new wound, making it look more serious. And look, the reason why I'm bringing up this point, other than the fact that it's important for this specific story, is that we hear this argument by people in authoritative positions all the time. I had to shoot and kill the person, right? They attacked me first. And we just believe them. We just immediately believe them. And we never, ever give the person who was unarmed and shot to death the benefit of the doubt. Never. Even though they're not even here to, you know, defend themselves.
And let alone prisoners. Yeah. When you start a conversation about prisoners, man, they're already guilty, man. They're in prison. And God knows what they did. And, of course, they're animals. The poor guards. Of course they had to protect themselves. So just next time anyone in authority tells you that something happened, maybe take it with a grain of salt and investigate a little bit and see if that's true or not.
I'm waiting around the train station, waiting for that train to take me away from that lonesome town. Too bad the girl don't love me no more than, and her people will be down.
Early in the last century, people of color were banned from living in certain parts of Seattle. The laws have changed, but remnants of this racial divide exist to this day. This prompted a listener's question for KUOW's Local Wonder.
This is David Newman. I live in Beacon Hill in Seattle. And my question is, why is Seattle so racially segregated?
To answer David's question, we sent out KUOW's Jamala Henderson.
In order to understand why Seattle seems or feels so racially segregated today, you need a glimpse at the city's past. It's a particular part of its history that people don't exactly enjoy talking about. Seattle is sunny and warm the day I meet up with University of Washington history professor Jim Gregory. We stand on the edge of East Montlake Park, where I can see boaters and their yachts motoring under the drawbridge and through the cut. It's truly one of the most beautiful areas of Seattle. But according to Dr. Gregory, it also represents the city's ugly history of racial segregation.
The Ship Canal is a profound barrier between North Seattle and the rest of Seattle, but also between white Seattle and multiracial Seattle.
He says the physical barrier has actually served as a moat.
A literal moat that has defended, in a symbolic sense, white Seattle from desegregation.
That's because to the north, neighborhoods were very white, and blacks and Asians were pushed to live south of the Ship Canal. In the early 20th century, it was legal for white people to ban blacks and Asians from buying houses in certain neighborhoods. White neighborhood groups and realtors did this by inserting what they called racial restrictive covenants into property deeds.
So other neighbors could sue a homeowner who decided to sell to a person of color, or in many cases, Jews were also prohibited in neighborhoods.
Adrian Bailey remembers what that time was like for people of color. She's 62 and has been an activist and used to work for Seattle Central College. As a child, she was given access to many parts of Seattle that her friends could never see.
My mom was a domestic, so that meant we had to go where white folks were. And me being the youngest, a lot of times I always had to go with her. So I always saw what the other world was.
But later in life, she learned about the barriers she and others had to endure. For instance, Bailey knew by word of mouth which realtors would and would not rent to people of color. And when it came to buying a house,
black people always had to use shields to buy a house.
What do you mean by shields?
White people. If you were going to buy a house, it would have to be the white person would have to be the one to sign off on it first. And then that person would turn around and sell it to you. You know, it was just, it was common practice.
Those common practices meant blacks in Seattle were pushed to live in specific parts of the city. And blacks and people of color were also deprived of access to loans and mortgages, a discriminatory practice known as redlining. Today, things are different. Because of steep housing prices, African Americans are being pushed out of the very neighborhoods they were originally forced into. And many have moved further south into areas like the Rainier Valley, Renton, and Kent. In the 70s, at its peak, the Central District was home to about 70% of the city's black population. Today, it's majority white. But there are those with deep family roots in the Central District who are doing their best to hang on to their homes however they can.
My grandfather purchased his first house here in the Central District in 1947.
Ine Wokoma is a photographer and a longtime resident of Seattle's central area. His grandfather and eventually other members of his family bought more houses in the area and lived in them for decades, including the house he lives in now.
My aunt died here. My great aunt died in the house next door. My great uncle died in the house across the street. Having property meant that family always had a place to stay. Meant that you always had people around you who were a part of who you are.
But over the years, financial problems hit Wokoma's family members, and many of them had to sell their homes and move. At their height, members of his family owned and lived in about 10 houses in the central area. Today, they have 3. For Wokoma, living in his grandfather's house gives him a sense of continuity of his family, from the past to the present and even to the future.
50, 75, 100 years in the future, will there be a place that my grandchildren and great-grandchildren can stand in and know that generations of their families live their lives in that space.
What we see today as racial segregation in Seattle is the legacy of discrimination from the city's past. Seattle does have more areas now that are more integrated than before. But James Gregory says there are still a lot of complicated pieces of segregation that live on in Seattle beneath the surface.
Segregation tends to reinforce itself, tends to perpetuate itself. There are a lot of processes involved. Some involve overt discrimination and subtle forms of discrimination. And then there are also just aversions and attractions that go on.
In other words, there are still people who feel more comfortable living near other people who look like them. I'm Jamala Henderson for KUOW's Local Wonder.
I wonder if infusions of $6 to $10 million like we've seen, while that's impressive, how far that really goes in a world where, you know, Terry's Bank is going up against Wells Fargo or Citibank, giant corporations. Is that a significant amount of cash in the real world? And how much more would this technologically driven movement need for a bank like Terry's or other black banks to really start to compete in ways that are that make an impact in the community?
Cash rules everything around me. Green, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo.
The wage gap between white and black Americans is worse today in 2016 than it was in 1979, according to a new report. The report by the Economic Policy Institute, known as the EPI, revealed that the gap between wages of both black and white men and black and white women has widened over the last 36 years. Let's look at some numbers. Black men's average hourly wages went from being 22% lower than those of white men in 1979 to being 31% lower by 2015. For women, the wage gap went from 6% in 1979 to 19% in 2015. The EPI report comes a week after the U.S. Census Bureau found that in 2015, median income for white Americans went up 4.4% and that of black Americans went up by 4.1%. So while everyone's income went up in 2015, a large racial divide remains. According to an article in The Guardian, the EPI report was especially bad for black women, especially those who were young. The researchers found that the current wave of inequality has hit young black women the hardest. Since 2000, when the gap began widening, it's black women just entering the workforce who have seen their wages fall the furthest compared with their white peers. Valerie Wilson, one of the report's authors and the director of the EPI's program on race, ethnicity and the economy, said, and I quote, "The finding that stands out the most, our major result, is that the racial wage gaps were larger in 2015 than they were in 1979. That's huge, because the impression people have in general is we know there's still racism in this country, but we think, or at least believe, that it's getting better," unquote. Really? People think it's getting better? This, as the United States and frankly the world, mourns the killing of unarmed black man Terrence Crutcher, whose SUV broke down in the middle of the street and he asked for help, and a 13-year-old black boy called Tyree King, both unarmed, both shot, both black, and both killed by the police. And this, as we then get news that Corinne Gaines, another young black woman, black mother, with her child, who was shot and killed by police, also unarmed, while in her home. And people think things are getting better. Really? Really? Dr. Trevor B. Lindsay, let me start with you.
I'm with you on the really. I mean, the statistic is just, there's so many statistics that are floating around right now that just make my blood boil. We say we rage and the whole damn system is guilty as hell, because at every level we're seeing this regression on these steps of progress that we usually use as markers. We use wealth as a marker. We use that we're no longer enslaved as a marker, or there's no longer apartheid as a marker. But then reading a statistic like yesterday that 1892 was the most violent year in terms of anti-black violence and lynching on record, and we actually surpassed that number this year with death of black people by police. So there's something really telling about the fact that I can use a statistic from 1892 to talk about 2016. And I think when we talk about that just on the level of surviving white supremacy and anti-blackness, that living and thriving under that is even more precarious. So the wage gap is unsurprising. And within the wage gap, again, looking at the gender dynamics of that, we still compare men to men and women to women, which is saying the study is starting from the point that women are going to make less than men. I mean, that's one part of this that's just blaring as well. But then in that, who then suffers the most in that system? And, of course, it's black women who we see this largest disparity. So our gap between white women, black men, and white men is widening at a rate that should be alarming to everyone. But, of course, it's not, because black women are the margins of the margins. And so I think what we're seeing in this moment, and why this moment is so important globally in terms of a movement for black lives and bringing up the afterlives of slavery, of colonialism, of apartheid, and other forms and iterations of white supremacy, is that we are seeing that the ability to survive, live, and thrive as black people is compromised by these newer iterations and technologies of anti-blackness. And one of the best ways to do that is to destroy the economic base of a community, which is happening, which is destroying kind of health outcomes in communities, which we see with the depletion of health access and affordability of health care and reform. And then on the literal level of survival here, not being able to know if you're going to make it home at night if your car breaks down, or not being able to be a kid out at night playing and get read as a grown man who's now a suspect in an armed robbery, or someone who is picking up their child and meeting in their car and is accosted by police. These are the instances just this week that give us an indication that anti-blackness is functioning at this level of survival. And a statistic like we're hearing out of the wage gap is hearing is talking about the living and thriving of black people. So if we survive, then we're surviving at these levels, which also reflect disparity, anti-blackness, and white supremacy operating full throttle. So what this tells me is that we're at a full throttle pace with the new technologies of white supremacy and the new systemic challenges of navigating it.
Kathleen Addy, your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with what Teresa is saying. I mean, to sit here and watch what is going on in the U.S. with black people being gunned down so indiscriminately, the law not being on their side, is actually horrifying. I'm sure you know, as you yourself grew up, we have a huge population of people, of Africans in the U.S. who are not part of the diaspora in that sense. They're not African Americans. They're just Africans who have moved to the U.S. for whatever reason. So what that means is that I have friends, I have schoolmates, I have family, you know, who are black men walking around the U.S. And every time one of these incidents happen, I say to myself, oh, my God, this could have been this person or that person. And I can't understand why it's going on and why it seems to be getting worse. I don't know whether, because media is now globalized, we see these things more often than we would have in the past. You know, so it's because of that we are getting all this information, or it's just happening more. But on the wage issue, there's an angle that is interesting. It's happening right here in Ghana and in most African countries as well. And that is the whole issue of expatriate. So white supremacy is not just happening where white people are a majority. It happens here where white people are a minority as well. Now, what tends to happen is that when companies get established, they would hire a lot of people who are not Ghanaians or who are not Africans, and they will pay these people several times more than they pay their African staff, even if they are on the same level. So we have expatriates who tend to be white people, mostly, who get housed in the most expensive parts of the city for free, whose kids' school fees get paid in expensive schools. We have people who are expatriates who also get, you know, all kinds of benefits that Ghanaians don't get. This is also part of a colonial legacy, because there's absolutely no reason why somebody coming from Europe to come and work in Ghana, by virtue of coming from Europe to work in Ghana, earns more. Because When people move from Ghana to go and work in Europe or the U.S., trust me, they are not labeled expats. They're labeled migrants. Economic migrants and other kinds of terms are used for them. And, of course, those terms do not attract the same. The inverse is not true for that situation. When black people go out to work elsewhere, they probably are paid less. And even if they are not paid less, they are definitely not paid more than other people who live in that geographical location. But when you come to Ghana and you go to most West African companies, check the mining companies, check the fast-moving consumer goods companies, check the financial institutions, there is a different way of remuneration for people who have come from Europe or elsewhere and are called expatriates. Even though we live in a world where that term is actually questionable. So, yes, it is ridiculous. And I agree with what Teresa said, that it's a reflection of white supremacy that is now being foisted on us in almost indirect ways, be it in places where we are a majority or a minority.
And this is so powerful to me because I think about the idea of this global anti-blackness and the insidiousness of white supremacy and its legacies infiltrating all these different areas in different ways. Even as we persist in these notions of progress and improvement. And so, you know, the idea that you can articulate a narrative of progress in the same week you are watching a list of fathers and children and women die at the hands of the state who are sworn to serve and protect. And then you can listen to a Ghanaian woman like Kathleen Addy break down and explain that actually being an expatriate, and of course we know the difference between an expatriate and an immigrant is usually just color, because immigrant really just means black and brown and expatriate really just refers to white. That's how that breaks down. And you're talking about the exact same work being given preferential treatment on the basis of color and the expectation of that by both Africans in Ghana, by Ghanaians, and by the white expatriates who come. And so we're reminded again how white supremacy's legacy requires major resistance on all fronts, but also an honest telling of the ways that it manifests, and that anti-blackness is not and has never been limited to white people. In these nations that are majority black, we're seeing manifestations of that anti-blackness as well. And so, yes, we rage, we continue to say the entire system, global, regional, domestic, national, is guilty as hell. And the fight against white supremacy's toll, its legacy, and our inheritance of this notion of black inferiority and white superiority that is a profound lie, but its lived reality manifests in something like the wage gap. It manifests in the narrative that Kathy shares with us. All of those things remind me of the, not just a luta continua, but what are the different ways that we need to fight in order to push back this tidal wave that just feels like a deluge, that means and feels like you're consistently drowning, even when you're swimming upstream and insisting that your right to be black, to live, to breathe, to earn equally, to thrive, to rock your natural, to rock your dreads, even when you insist on all of that, it is a battle that continues to be waged on all these different fronts. Black America is telling white America, black folk are telling white folk, pay me what you owe me.
I open up in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. I greet everyone at this press conference in the greeting words of peace of Assalamu Alaikum. I am not the official spokesperson for the city of Charlotte. Brother Corey Muhammad, he just pulled up. He is on his way. But being a media person and a longtime resident of the city of Charlotte, and we're watching our black men this week being gunned down, and there's no redress for our grievances of black people being killed. With our brother Scott, they said he had a gun. Somebody said he had a book. We need to do our own independent investigation to see if that is actually true. But what we're standing up for now is our black manhood and our black people who are being gunned down in the street, and we don't get no justice. So what I'm calling for and what we're calling for is an economic boycott of the whole city of Charlotte. Since black lives do not matter for this city, then our black dollar shouldn't matter.
All right, man.
Right? That's keep our money in our pocket and let you feel, see, we're watching modern day lynching on social media, on television, and it is affecting the psyche of black people. That's what you saw last night. This is what, when you don't get your justice, we don't get a redress for our grief, and we don't get justice, this is what you see, and you're going to see more of that. Right. We're not telling our brothers and sisters to stop. We're not going to get out there and tell y'all, oh, brother, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do this, when we ain't getting no justice. So everybody in Charlotte should be on notice that black people today, we tired of this bull. Right. We're tired of being killed and nobody saying nothing. We're tired of our political leaders going along to get along. They're so weak. They don't have no sympathy for our grief. And we want justice. So I say, take your money out of North Lake Mall. Take your money out of South Park Mall. Take your money out of the Epicenter. Hell, let's don't even have the CIAA this year. Right. How you going to party, have a drink in your hand, and we ain't getting no damn justice
that's right,
in
right.
here.
That's right, BJ.
So what we're saying is, we're calling on all black people in Charlotte to keep your money in your pocket and let the city of Charlotte, with their great shiny buildings and skyscrapers and panthers and hornets and all that, keep your money in your pocket and let everybody feel the pain economically of what we're feeling physically when you kill us.
Yes, sir.
So that's what we're calling for. We're calling for an economic boycott in the city of Charlotte. Don't spend no money with no white folks that don't respect us.
Right.
And that's all I got to say, brothers and sisters. And I thank you. I don't want to offend nobody, but hell, man, we don't got nothing to lose. We don't got nothing to feel, because we are offended. We are offended because we can't get no justice. And, you know, and the thing that is sad about it, when black people are killed, there's no sympathy on social media, on the radio, on television. Nobody wants to feel our pain. So the question is, what are you trying to force us to do? And I'm saying, take our money out of Charlotte and let's put it in our own community. Let's create our own Black Wall Street.
North Carolina.
In Northeast Charlotte yesterday, a Charlotte-Mecklenburg police officer shot and killed a black man. That prompted a night of angry protests. Police say they're still investigating, but here's what we know now. Officers went to an apartment complex off Old Concord Road to serve an arrest warrant. They saw 43-year-old Keith Lamont Scott sitting in a parked car. Police say he got out of the car with a gun, and that's when Officer Brentley Vinson, also an African-American, fired. Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Chief Kerr Putney said this morning he's not sure if the gun was loaded or if Scott threatened officers.
That is a part of the statements that we still have yet to get. But at this point, I don't know that he definitively pointed the weapon specifically towards an officer.
WFAE's Tom Bullock went back to the neighborhood this morning and says neighbors have a different account. Tom, what did you hear?
So it's important to note that there are two real dueling narratives that we're hearing throughout the day. Some of it is coming from government police officials, like we just heard from Kerr Putney, the chief of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. But neighbors in that development, in that neighborhood, have a very different view of what went down. And we're just going to report on what each is saying. We don't know which one is correct yet. But one woman, I spoke with one woman, David, who actually says she saw the incident, the shooting, take place. Her name is Tahisha Williams. And here's what she had to say.
That man had a book. I saw it when it fell off his lap when he got out the car to hold his hands up to show the police that he didn't have none. It fell off his lap right there in the middle of the street. So for him to say that he didn't have a book is crazy.
Now, that book reference is key. Police say he had a gun. His daughter, Mr. Scott's daughter, says it was a book. And neighbors I spoke to said he was often seen. It was part of his regular routine to be sitting at the spot where he was at that time of the shooting, with a book waiting for his son to get off the school bus. So the view, at least from the neighborhood, is the police are mistaken.
So we heard from some other folks there as well. I think John Barnett was there.
That's correct. And he's the head of True Healing Under God, or THUG. He calls it a civil rights group, and it has done a lot of civil rights work. But other civil rights organizations have sometimes separated themselves from the views of THUG because sometimes they can seem a bit extreme. But he, too, questioned the police account. And here's what Mr. Barnett said.
Did he intend to really sit in a vehicle
waiting on his son to get home from school, and then plot to shoot a cop if they pulled up on him.
No, no, he didn't.
The reality is that they told me that they, Mr. Scott sits here every day his vehicle wanting to pick up his son and give him a hug. And yesterday his son could not get that hug.
And while Mr. Barnett spoke at the neighborhood not far from where the shooting took place, in fact, just feet from the site, the neighbors all surrounded the press conference. You could hear them continually questioning the police. And Mr. Barnett also said something very interesting. Of course, the shooting is just part of this story. The longer part of the story is, of course, the protests that turned violent last night. We saw tear gas in Charlotte, which is not something you're used to seeing in this city. And here's what Mr. Barnett had to say about the violence.
Now, I do encourage the youth to be controlled, but I can't control them. Dr. King said a community that doesn't feel they have a stake in that community will unconsciously try to destroy you.
Right.
So guess what? I'm not saying tear down the Walmart, but we don't own it. I'm not saying burn down AutoZone, as I seen AutoZone burn down to the ground in Ferguson when I went there for Michael Brown's funeral, but we don't own it.
And by we, he's referring to the African-American community. Now, though that statement is pretty inflammatory, its true meaning I leave up to whoever is listening. But he did also come out and say that he's calling on protesters to go down to a park not far from Government Center, Marshall Park, at 7 p.m. for an organized protest. We'll see if that changes the dynamic tonight.
So, Tom, there were one group that was missing was the family. Have we heard from them yet?
No, we have not specifically heard from the family. Mr. Barnett did say that he has spoken with the family, that they are that they're grieving, and he also happened to mention that they will be on CNN tomorrow. But the press was not allowed to speak to the family at the press conference I was at.
Now, some folks are calling for a boycott.
That's correct. Specifically, an African-American boycott of Charlotte businesses. The person who called for that today at the press conference was B.J. Murphy from the Nation of Islam. But others that spoke there, all, you know, Christian reverends, again, Mr. Barnett, also called for an African-American boycott of white-owned Charlotte businesses.
So, Tom, what can we expect tonight?
That, David, is the question. Obviously, we can expect more protests. It sounds like there'll be something down at Marshall Park. Whether or not we see the same level of violence and the same police response obviously depends on what the protesters do there. But I've also heard that there may be protests in other parts of the city. So stay tuned.
WFAE's Tom Bullock, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And another one. And another one. It's so gorgeous. It's another beautiful day in North Carolina, y'all. Y'all should really be here to see it.
Welcome back, everyone, to our breaking news. Live pictures now from Charlotte, a third night of protests in that city. The mayor ordering a midnight curfew in the hopes of keeping her city calm this evening. Meanwhile, a congressman who represents North Carolina, who was a guest on this show last night, is apologizing now for saying there were riots in Charlotte because the protesters, quote, hate white people. Joining me now exclusively to explain is Congressman Robert Pittenger of North Carolina. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us this evening. You doing okay?
Yes, sir.
Good evening. I want to start with something that you told the BBC earlier today about why we're seeing these protests, what their grievances are. Here it is.
The grievance in their mind is the animus, the anger. They hate white people because white people are successful and they're not. I mean, yes, it is. It is a welfare state. We have spent trillions of dollars on welfare, but we put people in bondage so that they can't be all that they're capable of being.
You care to explain your comments, Congressman?
Well, thank you for this opportunity. You know, I agree for my city. I love Charlotte. Wonderful people. I know many pastors in the African American community, and I trust and support them so much, and I am hurt by what's taking place. And frankly, I apologize for the comments. They certainly weren't meant in the context of how many have viewed them. My concern, frankly, is for the disfranchised individuals. Mm-hmm. And those, frankly, I was quoting is what they were saying last night that I observed on your network, and their hatred for white people. And that saddens me greatly.
You believe the protesters? You believe the protesters hate white people?
Well, no, sir. It's what the comment that they made. I think you'll go back and look at the tapes. The comments that they made on air. And
you mean the protesters made on air?
Yes, sir. I was only trying to convey what they were saying, and yet it didn't come out right. And I apologize. Mm-hmm. I have many, many dear friends in the African-American community, and those, frankly, and my colleagues in the United States Congress, and I've gone to them tonight and really apologize to them, because that certainly is not the spirit of who I am.
But let's walk through what you said. You said they hate us because we're successful. They hate
white people
because white people are successful. How is that taken out of context, with all due respect?
Sure. Well, I think what I'm trying to communicate was that what has occurred with the economy has left them out. When you look, frankly, at the last 8 years of the current economy, the demographic group who has moved the least up the economic ladder are low-income minority people. And that's the reality. That's a fact. So, my desire is that every individual will have the right for an opportunity economy. Yeah. That's what America's about.
You understand that the facts and the statistics show that over the last, of course, you know, we were in one of the biggest economic downturns in history, but it shows that African Americans are doing better when it comes to unemployment. It's been cut in half, and it's better than any other time in history. So the facts don't really jibe with what you're saying. African Americans and minorities, of course, are always hardest hit whenever there's any type of downturn. Do you understand
that? Sir, respectfully, I would say to you that we're growing at only 1.3% economic growth.
That's for everyone in the country, though. That's
not
just for African Americans.
That's what I'm saying. So it's bad for all of them. But when you look at the studies, and the studies are valid, that the group that has grown the least economically, and this is a broad number of economists who conveyed this, have been low-income minority people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're only creating maybe an average of 170,000 jobs a month over the last 8 years. And we can do much better than that. Yeah. Well, we are burdened down with regulations that restrict our economy. It restricts job growth. You know, I was on a community bank board for 10 years. I'm on financial services committee now. And small businesses today can't get credit. They can't get capital. Yeah. And they can't grow. They can't create jobs. And that used to be the large measure of new jobs created in this country. Yeah. And so when you can't grow a bigger pie, it hurts everyone. But disproportionately, frankly, it has hurt the African-American community more.
Well, it is African-American community. African-Americans have always been at the bottom of the economic realm, even with 43 other presidents and in other administrations. That's just because of the history of this country. I would encourage all of our viewers who are watching to do their research and look at the facts and the numbers, and not just to rhetoric that happens on the campaign trail or because of ideology.
No,
but I would have
to
hang on. I don't want to argue with you about the numbers. I understand that. I have to respect at least that you're coming on to discuss this. So let's talk about, you also said that we're in a welfare state. That sort of language is offensive to African Americans as well. What did you mean by that?
Well, I mean that we've spent, since 1965, around $20 trillion. We have 80 separate welfare programs that cost about $800 billion a year. And we have restricted the life and the opportunity of many people. Because we have provided programs that don't allow them to grow and to be who they can be.
Do you say that same thing to white people who are on welfare? Because there's a large number of white people who are on welfare
as
well.
Yes, I would say that. I think the entire welfare programs need to be reviewed and reformed.
Okay. So let me ask you, while I have you here, what would you say tonight in order to correct the record and change your message? Was this a learning point for you at all? What do you want to say to the people who are watching?
Well, I love my community, and I am very sorry for the way of how I said what I said. My desire is that everyone could grow up the economic ladder and have experience the greatest benefit of the American opportunity. And so I've come on the air just to apologize in every way I can to say that the way I've said it and how it's communicated wasn't the best way, it wasn't the most appropriate way, and I apologize.
As a leader, what are you going to do to fix that? Because words can be hollow sometimes. There has to be action behind
it. I appreciate that. Well, that's what we're about. We have reforms we call A Better Way, and I hope that viewers will go and they'll look at a better way. because we provide reforms we feel like can change this country and give opportunity for everybody, no matter where they are on the economic ladder or whatever their racial involvement is. We want everyone to succeed and be all that they can be in this country.
Congressman Robert Pittenger, thank you. I appreciate you coming back on.
Sure. Good to be with you.
These are not isolated incidents. They're symptomatic of a broader set of racial disparities that exist in our criminal justice system. And I just want to give people a few statistics to try to put in context why emotions are so raw around these issues. Last year, African Americans were shot by police at more than twice the rate of whites.
Damn you, Obama.
Steve Clevenger, backup catcher for the Mariners, finds himself in some hot water after a couple of ill-advised tweets, now deleted tweets, but deleting tweets in 2016 does nothing.
Yeah, it turns out people, when they see something really controversial, they will screenshot it and then post it everywhere. And that's how we found out about these alleged tweets from Steve Clevenger that, as you point out, have since been deleted, all in response, seemingly, to last night's riots in Charlotte after the shooting death of Keith Lamont Scott by a police officer. One of the tweets says, BLM, Black Lives Matter, BLM is pathetic once again. Obama, you are pathetic once again. Everyone involved should be locked behind bars like animals. Now, that alone is not the worst thing in the world. Their imagery of animals when talking about people who are rioting can certainly be applied. But, of course, it's still a little edgy for any professional athlete.
Wow, that's an understatement.
A little edgy.
You know what? This one alone?
Okay. Alone, you can at least say, okay, that's edgy. You can at least make an argument either way, depending on your perspective going into it. But the other tweet, it makes everything really bad. Black people beating whites when a thug got shot holding a gun by a black officer. Ha ha, S word, cracks me up. Keep kneeling for the anthem. That goes beyond edgy. Here's the thing. Like, he could have artfully made a similar point and did it in a respectful way that was a little bit more nuanced and a little bit more intellectual. But if these tweets are actually by him and it wasn't, like, hacked, and I throw that out there as a potential,
do you think he'll even try that excuse? Because that was Anthony Weiner's initial excuse. We're not really buying the hack thing anymore.
It didn't work for him. So the Mariners put out a statement saying, the Seattle Mariners are very disappointed at the tweets posted on Steve Clevenger's account. While he is certainly free to express himself, his tweets do not in any way represent the opinions of the Seattle Mariners. We strongly disagree with the language and the tone of his comments. We are currently examining all internal options that are available to us as we determine appropriate next steps. We will have no further comment at this time. Now, I'm assuming they're looking at his contract. I'm assuming they look at union rules as to what exactly you can do. If anything, it does seem to indicate that they're taking this very seriously, as I think they should, and there might be some kind of punishment for him.
I'm sure there'll be some repercussions.
Sure.
This guy was brought in a Mark Trumbo trade. It sent him to the Baltimore Orioles, and he's hit 43 home runs this year. Steve Clevenger has four, which for him, he's kind of a fringe player. He's not all that valuable to the team. Why would you put your job in jeopardy? Now, honest to God, I hope he doesn't lose his job because of this. Not because I agree with what he said. It's just you're talking about stripping someone of their livelihood because of probably 60 frantic, stupid, ill-advised seconds in his life. I was also looking at the timestamp. You would think you would see these kind of tweets at like 1:40 a.m. after you've had a few. You're just watching coverage. You're like, I've just had it with blacks. And then you just take to Twitter. And, of course, Twitter doesn't have the are you sure option. So he just sends them. These were sent at 1:25 p.m. today. What was going on in Steve Clevenger's world at 1:25 p.m. today?
He had a full day's worth of reflection on the events that happened last night, and he decided to he was probably thinking this last night, and something stopped him. Someone in his life was like, don't do it.
I think he's had this thought for 30 years that every time he's seen a situation like this, this has been his take on it. This isn't a line of thinking that you all of a sudden develop because of a reaction to one situation.
Sure, but maybe this has happened not for years, but over, I mean, he's making reference specifically to Black Lives Matter. And it's certainly possible that he looks at how certain people respond to shootings like the one in Charlotte, and this could have been the last straw. And ultimately, I here's the weird thing. Like, what he said was awful. I understand the frustration with what he's seeing in Charlotte, right? I mean, I understand it. You understand it. We've had those conversations, and yet we didn't have to go towards arguably racist ways to talk about it. You and I were able, and most people, I think, are able to have conversations that can be complex and very emotional and very passionate and not necessarily...
Did you say arguably racist? Because if this isn't racist, then what is?
I just have a hard time just flat out calling someone who I have one tweet from, like, just as a... The comment is racist. Is he a racist? I don't know. I would say...
At 1:25 p.m. today, he was.
If I were only judging him by this tweet, I would say yes. But I also understand that that's not fair. I do. And again, I just don't know this guy. I don't. And I understand where he's coming from. I disagree with how he's saying it. I disagree with one of the tweets in its entirety. I disagree with most of the second tweet or the first tweet. But I understand his anger. So I guess I don't want to just jump on him. This is Steve Clevenger. To your point, he's not an important athlete. And I wonder if because he realizes that is his role, that maybe he doesn't think anyone's checking out his Twitter account. I don't know if that should matter. I mean, when you brought that up, the first thing I was like, does that matter that he's not an A-list Mariners player?
Yes.
Why?
Because, I mean,
if he was a star and he did this, would you give him a pass?
Performance can really overshadow a lot of your misgivings. No, but let me give you an example. A guy named Ray Lewis played for the Baltimore Ravens, the cornerstone of that defense. He had some off the field issues, including a murder trial, and never was he taken off the team because they really needed him to win.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Is it true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Rebecca Lee teaches at Kipp Tulsa College Prep, where a daughter of Terrence Crutcher is in the sixth grade. Terrence Crutcher is the 40-year-old man, father of four, shot to death by Tulsa police on September 16 after he halted his vehicle in the middle of a road. A white Tulsa police officer has been charged with manslaughter. Rebecca Lee helped three groups of school children in Tulsa try to talk about their fears and feelings and posted some of her own on Facebook. I look at the wide-eyed faces of the fifth graders surrounding me, she wrote. I ask them, what are your thoughts? They answer with questions. Why did they have to kill him? Why were they afraid of him? What will she do at father-daughter dances? Hasn't this happened before? As the questions roll, so do the tears. The second group was sixth graders. When I opened the floor for discussion, Rebecca Lee wrote, silence. It hurts to talk about. It hurts to think about. It hurts. I give them the space to process silently. Then I tell them, we have different skin colors. I love you. You matter. You are worthy. You are human. You are valuable. Shoulders shake harder around the circle. I realize that this is the first time all year I have affirmed my love for them. The third group of students were older, 13 and 14. They are hardened. They are angry, Rebecca Lee posted. What made him a big bad dude, a boy asks. Was it his height, his size? I look at the boys in my circle, all former students of mine. They have grown inches since their first day in my class. Their voices have deepened, their shoulders broadened. They all nod their heads in agreement at the student's last guess. The color of his skin? I share this story, the teacher wrote, because Mr. Crutcher's death does not just affect the students at my school. We are creating an identity crisis in all our black and brown students. Do I matter? Am I to be feared? Should I live in fear? Am I human? We are shaping their worldview with blood and bullets, hashtags and viral videos. Is this how we want them to feel? Is this how we want them to think? I share this story because I spent the last 2 years teaching kids that we write to interact with and understand the world, that our voices matter, and that our voices deserve to be heard. I would ask that you love, and love hard. Words this week from Rebecca Lee, a school teacher in Tulsa.
By so many measures, our country is stronger and more prosperous than it was 8 years ago. And none of it's been quick, none of it's been easy, none of it has come without a fight. and so much of our work remains unfinished. But then we knew that we would not solve all of our challenges in 1 year or one term or even one presidency, not even in one lifetime. Because we understand better than anybody that this is the story of America, that the project of America is never finished. It is constantly a work in progress. And what has always made us unique is our capacity to change. Our conviction. The change doesn't come from some ruler, but it comes from the bottom up, from us, from the actions we take, whether it's women seeking the right to vote or a young John Lewis leading a mighty march in Selma. We do our part to slowly, steadily make our union a little bit more perfect. We know that. And that's what we've done these past 8 years. And now that's what we have to keep on doing. You may have heard Hillary's opponent in this election say that there's never been a worse time to be a black person. I mean, he missed that whole civics lesson about slavery and Jim Crow. But we got a museum for him to visit. So he can tune in. We will educate him. He says we got nothing left to lose. So we might as well support somebody who has fought against civil rights and fought against equality and who has shown no regard for working people for most of his life. Well, we do have challenges, but we're not stupid. We know the progress we've made, despite the forces of opposition, despite the forces of discrimination, despite the politics of backlash. And we intend to keep fighting against those forces. When governors refuse to expand Medicaid that hits the folks most in need, we'll fight. When folks block an increase to the minimum wage or refuse to expand paid family leave or won't guarantee equal pay for equal work that hurts the pocketbooks of every family and African-American families, we will fight. When we're not investing in the schools that our kids deserve, when one group of Americans is treated differently under the law, when there are those who somehow think it's wrong to make sure that folks have access to affordable housing or are unwilling to do what it takes to make sure our veterans get the benefits that they've earned or aren't helping to sign folks up for health insurance. We will not stop our march for justice. We will not stop pushing for the security and prosperity of all people. That doesn't stop with my presidency. We're just getting started. And when across this country in 2016, there are those who are still trying to deny people the right to vote, we've got to push back twice as hard. Right now, in multiple states, Republicans are actively and openly trying to prevent people from voting, adding new barriers to registration, cutting early voting, closing polling places in predominantly minority communities, refusing to send out absentee ballots, kicking people off the rolls, often incorrectly. This should be a national scandal. We were supposed to have already won that fight. We're the only advanced democracy in the world that is actively discouraging people from voting. It's a shame. And then they try to justify it by telling folks that voter fraud is rampant. No, our work's not done. But
If we are going to advance the cause of justice and equality and prosperity and freedom, then we also have to acknowledge that even if we eliminated every restriction on voting, we would still have one of the lowest voting rates among free peoples. That's not good. That is on us. And I am reminded of all those folks who had to count bubbles in a bar of soap, beaten trying to register voters in Mississippi, risked everything so that they could pull that lever. So if I hear anybody saying their vote does not matter, that it doesn't matter who we elect, read up on your history. It matters. We've got to get people to vote. If you want to give Michelle and me a good send-off, and that was a beautiful video, but don't just watch us walk off into the sunset now. Get people registered to vote. If you care about our legacy, realize everything we stand for is at stake. All the progress we've made is at stake in this election. My name may not be on the ballot, but our progress is on the ballot. Tolerance is on the ballot. Democracy is on the ballot. Justice is on the ballot. Good schools are on the ballot. Ending mass incarceration, that's on the ballot right now. And there is one candidate who will advance those things. And there is another candidate whose defining principle, the central theme of his candidacy, is opposition to all that we've done. There's no such thing as a vote that doesn't matter. It all matters. And after we have achieved historic turnout in 2008 and 2012, especially in the African American community, I will consider it a personal insult, an insult to my legacy, if this community lets down its guard and fails to activate itself in this election. You want to give me a good send-off? Go vote! And I'm going to be working as hard as I can these next 7 weeks to make sure folks do. Hope is on the ballot. And fear is on the ballot, too. Hope is on the ballot and fear is on the ballot, too.
Damn you, Obama.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 24th, 2016. So I have been told. This is our compensatory call-in. Looking forward to hearing commentary, suggestions, thoughts, observations from non-white listeners. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Few quick things before we get to some of the folks who dialed in and share their thoughts. Number one, this is listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest. You can visit our blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Racism www.charlotte-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported us nearly 8 years. I hope the program has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. I also want to get my piece of gratitude in for Mr. Scotty Reed, founder of the Black Talk Radio Network. My microphone was, for some reason, not set to my headset at the beginning, and I was picking up some of the background noise. He gave me a heads up so I could make the adjustment and continue without the disruption to the broadcast. Thank you kindly, Mr. Scotty Reed. I was going to read one report at the beginning of the week, but then I just got the audio of President Barack Obama. That last piece of audio that you heard, he was speaking at the Congressional Black Caucus. They had a event over the past weekend, and he gave a commentary there. You heard a portion of it there. We had some listeners who wanted us to include some of his remarks about the African-American Museum, the Smithsonian's African-American Museum, that had its grand opening this weekend in Washington, D.C. I did listen to his remarks. I will note that he used the term context regularly when talking about the purpose for that museum, both today, the remarks where he spoke for about 40 minutes. Yesterday morning, he also gave a talk for about 20 minutes or so, and he used context in both of the different commentaries. I did not include anything on the museum because most of it seemed like a celebration. Not that I have anything against the museum. If I get to Washington, D.C., I would love an opportunity to go check it out and see what's there. If we have listeners that are in the D.C. area, if you live there or if you are going to take a visit there, definitely check it out and make a report. You know, if you can write a blog or write a report or do a video, I think that would be great about what your experience was. And if it has some constructive information about racism, that would be grand. But given everything that has happened globally within the system of white supremacy, I did not exactly feel I was not in a celebratory mood about the museum, given everything that has gone on this week and just being under the system of racism, white supremacy. There's nothing really to celebrate. Glad they got the museum. Let's solve the problem of racism, white supremacy. I don't think opening that museum is going to correct that problem. I could be in error. The one report that I was going to read was talking about President Obama's remarks at the Congressional Black Caucus. You got to hear quite a bit of what he had to say, particularly about it being a personal insult to him if black people particularly do not get out and vote. And to me, his commentary very much suggested not that you go out and vote for Jill Stein or Gary Johnson. It's specifically you have to go out and vote for Hillary Clinton if you want to avoid personally insulting President Obama and or ruining his legacy, whatever that means. But this has been a part of a wave. This is why earlier this year I kind of gave some of my thoughts rejecting, because you hear it every 4 years when it's election time, this notion that it is ridiculous. I think the cliche, the way they say it, is you can't complain if you don't vote. I've heard that my entire life. It's absolute nonsense. I'm not going to take time here to explain it again, but that is kicking up. But it's even further the rhetoric that people are promoting this time around. I have never heard commentary like what I'm hearing now. It's not just if you don't vote, you should be chastised and admonished. It's if you do not vote for a specific candidate, Hillary Clinton, you are irresponsible and stupid and ignorant and need to be lashed. That's pretty much what I've heard from a wide variety of people, not just what you just heard from President Barack Obama. They had Kerry Washington, the star of Scandal. I guess that'd be a cowbell. She was on Bill Maher a week ago, not last night, but a week ago yesterday. She was on Bill Maher. She had her Hillary Clinton button on. She's super pregnant now, but she was on Bill Maher. And she said it's irresponsible
to vote for a third-party candidate. It's irresponsible to not vote at all. And it seemed like she was talking specifically to black people with her message, where she said Hillary Clinton has acknowledged she has made some errors, her super predator comment. She has acknowledged her flaws, and she's looking to make corrections. And we have got to go out and support her. And it has been a mobilized effort, particularly to get black people to come out. And it's like they have talking points. I don't know if they have, you know, disseminated information to get everybody on the same page. Maybe that'll come out in the WikiLeaks documents about the Democratic National Party and what they've been doing. But they have been all basically using the same type of language in how they have been talking specifically to black people. I have not heard, if anybody has, I have not heard anybody criticizing Jill Stein and saying that you need to drop out right now. You're irresponsible and childish for running as a Green Party candidate. I haven't heard anybody say that to Gary Johnson, that you're irresponsible and stupid and ignorant. And you need to cancel your campaign right now because you're going to mess it up and allow Donald Trump to get in the White House. I haven't heard anybody direct that sort of verbiage at them. It's just been at black people. The comment that I will read, the article rather that I will read, this is Charles Blow. He is a black male. Dr. Welsing, myself, and others have pointed out that he has written quality material before, pointing out racism, white supremacy. I know he had a piece specifically in 2014. He writes for the New York Times. He writes op-ed pieces. He had a piece in 2014 right after the killing of Michael Brown. That was great. I think I quoted from it on the program before. Dr. Welsing really appreciated that piece. He is a victim of racism, but he has written the same type of thing. So the article that he wrote this week, The Folly of the Protest, he writes, "Last week I delivered a speech at the impressive campus of Morgan State University, a historically black college in northeast Baltimore. A woman approached the mic during the question and answer period to raise an issue that she and I both found frustrating: what to say to young people, particularly young African Americans, who have decided either not to vote in the forthcoming presidential election or to cast a protest vote for a third-party candidate who will most assuredly lose. This is a very real issue this cycle. Many of these young people feel that there is no good choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. On September 4th, the New York Times published an article pointing out the devastating impact this lack of enthusiasm could have on Clinton's prospects. Young African Americans, like all voters their age, are typically far harder to drive to the polls than middle-aged and older Americans. Yet, with just over 2 months until Election Day, many Democrats are expressing alarm at the lack of enthusiasm and, in some cases, outright resistance some black millennials feel toward Mrs. Clinton." The article continued, "Their skepticism is rooted in a deep discomfort with the political establishment that they believe the 68-year-old former First Lady and Secretary of State represents. They share a lingering mistrust of Mrs. Clinton and her husband over criminal justice issues. They are demanding more from politicians as part of a new confrontational wave of black activism that has arisen in response to police killings of unarmed African Americans. Furthermore, as Farah Chidea pointed out on 538, an ABC News Washington Post poll released last week found that among black Americans of all ages, Clinton is leading Trump 93% to 3%, but an August survey of young voters by Gen Forward found that 60% of black Americans aged 18 to 30 supported Clinton, or about 30 percentage points less than African Americans at large. 14% of black millennials said they would not vote, 5% said they would vote for the Green or Libertarian candidates, and 2% planned to vote for Trump. When I am confronted by the not voting or protest voting crowd, their argument often boils down to one of principle. They can't possibly vote for Trump or Clinton because they are flawed in their own ways. I know immediately that they have bought into the false equivalency nonsense, and additionally are conflating the casting of a ballot with an endorsement of a candidate's shortcomings. Both ideas are incredibly problematic and potentially self-destructive. First and foremost, this cannot be said enough. Clinton and Trump are not equally bad candidates. One is a conventional politician who has a long record of public service, full of pros and cons. The other is a demagogic bigot with a puddle deep understanding of national and international issues who openly courts white nationalism, is hostile to women, Mexicans, and Muslims, and is callously using black people as pawns in a Donnie-come-lately kinder, gentler campaign. Second, a vote isn't just about the past, although comparing these two candidates on their pasts still leaves one as the clear choice, but about the present and future. There is a simple truth here. Either Clinton or Trump will be the next president of the United States, not Jill Stein, not Gary Johnson, Clinton or Trump. There is another truth. That person will appoint someone to fill the current vacancy on the Supreme Court, assuming that the Senate doesn't find religion and move on Merrick Garland before the new president takes office, and that person will appoint federal judges to fill 88 district court and court of appeals vacancies that now exist. There are 51 nominees pending for these seats. The judgeships alone could cast a long shadow, not just one or two terms of a presidency, but for decades until those judges retire or die. This election isn't just about you or me or Clinton or Trump. This election is quite literally about the future, all of our and our children's and their children's futures. You can't say you're upset about police interaction with minority communities and not understand that the courts are where police tactics are challenged and where precedent is set. You can't care about this issue and risk having those judicial seats filled by a man who allowed Sheriff David Clark, there he is again, to speak at his nomination convention. Sheriff Clark has called Black Lives Matter a separatist movement compromising slimy people with a hateful ideology that should be added to the list of hate groups in America. You can't care about this issue and risk the ascendance of a man who last week was endorsed by the Fraternal Order of Police, a group that in its questionnaire to candidates claims fringe organizations have been given a platform by the media to convey the message that police officers are a militarized enemy and it is time to attack that enemy. The questionnaire goes further. There is a very real and very deliberate campaign to terrorize our nation's law enforcement officers, and no one has come to our defense. This, of course, is cop fantasy, but this group is the nation's largest police union, representing some 330,000 officers. You can't care about this issue and risk the ascendance of a man who said of black people this week that they are absolutely in the worst shape they've ever been in before, and has said before that his key to restoring safety in black communities is in part more law enforcement. You can't have taken part in a march for Eric Garner chanting "I can't breathe" and risk the ascendance of a man who has as one of his chief advisors Rudy Giuliani, the grandfather of the very broken windows policing strategy that sent officers after low-level offenders like Garner. You can't have supported the marching in Ferguson and applaud the Justice Department's findings that the city was systemically oppressing its black citizens and allow Trump to pick the next attorney general. You can't have been enraged by the video of Freddie Gray and risk the ascendance of a man who tweeted about the unrest that followed. Our great African American president hasn't exactly had a positive impact on the thugs who are so happily and openly destroying Baltimore. You can't be irate about environmental injustice in Flint and risk the ascendance of a man who didn't set foot in that city this cycle until the final stretch of the campaign when he was engaged in his fake black outreach, and even after he did, he attacked the pastor who interrupted him and lied about details of the visit. You can't allow that man to pick the next head of the Environmental Protection Agency. You can't have cried about Tamir Rice's case and allowed the ascendance of a candidate who would have his convention in the city where Tamir was killed and not even once reach out to Tamir's mother or invite her to the convention. You can't allow the ascendance of a candidate with the audacity to return to Cleveland to tape a town hall with his television booster Sean Hannity about issues facing African American community, taped in front of a largely white audience judging by the pictures, and still not reach out to Tamir's mother to participate. Tamir's blood cries out for better. You can't detest racial dragnet policy stop and frisk policing as not only morally abhorrent but thoroughly unconstitutional and risk the ascendance of a man who on Wednesday reportedly suggested that he would consider using stop and frisk more across the nation. You can't pretend to be enlightened or woke or principled and sit idly by and allow real and sustained damage to be done to the very causes you hold dear. You can't in good conscience compare Trump to the candidate who has embraced the mothers of the movement, has an expansive racial justice agenda outlined on her website, has been engaged with Flint for months, and has won the praise of that city's mayor, and will surely appoint more liberal judges. As Bernie Sanders himself said last week, this is not the time for a protest vote. Protest voting or not voting at all isn't principled. It's dumb and childish and self-immolating. I know you're young, but grow up. That is Mr. Charles M. Blow, The Folly of the Protest Vote, September 22nd, 2016. And as I said, the rhetoric has been very similar, as though they all have the same talking points. You're childish, you're irresponsible. If you don't, and it's not even just if you don't vote, it's if you don't vote for Hillary Clinton. Mr. Blow, President Obama, Kerry Washington, and anybody else can take it personal. Gusty Renegade is not voting for Hillary Clinton, and I would encourage that no black person vote for her either. I would much rather have, I can't even give the metaphor, I would rather have someone that generally is recognized as a racist white supremacist in the White House so that there's no confusion about what system we're in, as opposed to someone that we have been tricked into thinking cares about black people is going to work to solve this problem. We will hit the phone lines. The number to dial is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. If we could not use metaphor, because and there were a lot of metaphors in there as well. I just will not point them out for time's sake, but lots of metaphors in there, and in President Obama, lots of metaphors there as well. I always, if we're talking about racism, I'm very cautious when the metaphors start to pile up, because it might be that we are just being led emotionally for something that sounds good, as opposed to really stopping to evaluate, is what is being said logical? Is it accurate, and what are the details? So if we could not use metaphors, just be precise, explicit, exact about what it is that you're saying, as opposed to relying on metaphors, would super appreciate it. I will prompt about that as we go. Folks who dialed in with a hand up should be with us, or at least the first set of people who dialed in with a hand up will be with us, and I will nab other folks as we roll. Feel free to share your views.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, greetings to Gus, all the listeners and the callers. I'd like to first start with the unemployment thing. A few years ago at my job, we were having down weeks. We may have like two or one every other month. So we had to collect unemployment. Then the reason for that was because there were lack of parts coming in. As time went on, everything became steady, so there was straight work. During that time, there were a whole bunch of white people that were still collecting unemployment, and they were still working. I think it took about maybe a year for unemployment to catch up with them, and about 30 to 35 white people got fired at my job. The next thing is... I have mixed feelings about the corrections officer thing. As you all know, I had a brother that was lynched in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania prison. And I also have a brother that's a corrections officer in New Jersey. So I have mixed feelings about that. I did hear stories from my brother who's the corrections officer. He said how sometimes he might have to correct some of the white officers when they quote unquote get out of line. I asked him what he meant, and he didn't really want to go into too much details, but he said sometimes they might talk to the inmates incorrectly or say something. And he did mention one time that he wanted to see that this one prison guard get put on his backside. he said that this guy constantly gets out of line with people, and my brother sees it as if you come in someone's house and you're disrespectful to them, then they have the right to do whatever they want to you. So I guess that's what he was trying to explain to me at that time. This happened like years ago. And then also with the football thing, whites in football, they take that very serious. The Eagles game is big out here in Pennsylvania, and they play it throughout the plant, throughout the warehouse. And I did hear a guy saying if they lose, that he was going to split cars in a parking lot or something similar to that. So, yeah, they take football very, very serious. And also, I found something that was pretty interesting. I'm not sure if you know about it, Gus. It's something in Seattle I had ran across where they were talking about it's supposed to be a safe haven for, I'm assuming it's white junkies. You can use any drug, and they supply you with clean syringes, and you can't go to jail for using any type of drug at this place. They called it a consumption, a safety consumption facility. I'm not sure if you heard about that.
I am very familiar with that. I've talked about it some of the programs that we've had that have talked about drugs and legalization and the different treatment that white addicts get as opposed to what they've done to black people, and not just those safe spaces that you're talking about where white heroin addicts can go shoot up. And they've even, when they've talked about this consistently, they have talked about how the reason that they have these quote-unquote liberal progressive programs is because Seattle and Washington State on the whole is so overwhelmingly white. But they are now talking about having public housing where you can also consume your drugs and not be evicted from your public housing, which, I mean, that is appalling for the number of black people over the years, and not just a black person that was suffering some substance abuse, but if it was a black person who was a substance abuse, had substance abuse issues, and maybe they were staying with a parent, a grandparent, or relative, that relative also could have been tossed. I mean, that happened thousands of times. It's probably happening right now. But, yeah, I'm very familiar with that.
Yeah, from what I've read, allegedly, these people can use the drugs legally. They can't go to jail, and they can use it in a safe environment. So I thought that was interesting. And I'll mute for now and share a little bit more later.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. First, I would say to you, Gus, I think you were very accurate on your analysis of the subject of the presidential elections. I cannot consciously comfortably vote for a white person for anything, to tell you the truth, let alone talking about a white female and the illogical expressions of why to do that, that racist white supremacists, along with some, in my opinion, confused non-white black people are suggesting for us to do so. Marks of evidence wasn't the, something like the first 14 people who were presidents of this part of the world were slave owners, from my understanding. Within the lifetime of a lot of some people who are still living today during what is called the 60s, which is supposed to be the basically a understanding of non-white black people fighting against the system of racism, for the most part, from 1960 to something like 1968, all of the presidents were from the Democratic Party, as far as my knowledge. And then when Richard Milhouse Nixon was president. I can't see Mr. Trump worse than him. I'm not saying that I'm voting for him either, but he literally destroyed all just about every effort and boldly stated that he was going to do so. Any efforts on non-white people, and this point in time, non-white black people who were considered to be young people, Black Panther Party and whatnot, and literally said that I'm going out to destroy these efforts. I kind of like wonder what people are talking about on this subject presently, and if they're accurate based on what is history, you know, for that concern. So you're very, very accurate, in my opinion, and very logical on your understandings that you expressed. That's the key point, very logical on it. Back to what I was speaking about on Thursday. I've been a football coach on the high school level, specifically with my intent is to be in contact with young non-white black males. I purposely plot and planned to be in those kind of positions, and I have been in those type of positions now since 1981, and have only been under the guidance of one white male who was the head coach, and that's when I first started, and that was only for about maybe 3-4 years. Other than that, the majority, overwhelmingly, of the coaches that I worked with were other non-white black males. And primarily, I would say at least 90 or more of the players that I was in contact with were non-white black males. What's unique about this particular team, since getting there in the spring of 2015, we're up to now about, I'm thinking 4 or 5 of them have been shot, different occasions. The latest was last Saturday. And what I'm speaking about, to bring things in a more scientific understanding of racial white supremacy, with the advent of racial white supremacy going on for so long, and non-white people are either unable to or in some cases unwilling to focus on understanding the problem, the hows, what, whens, and wheres. A lot of us have an understanding of the symptoms, but as far as the how, what, whens, and wheres, we don't have an understanding of it. What takes place out of that is we act negatively upon one another. And in turn, even on the level of what is considered to be children, it occurs, as a lot of us who are listeners on this program have an understanding of. And in turn, this particular occasion, this latest occasion, it was a quote-unquote Sweet 16 party. And this is how these things take place, you know, very subtle. Someone said something that somebody else didn't like. But in this particular case, what is getting popular because of the weapons that are available in areas that don't produce weapons, a car would come around and just start shooting. And in turn, at least 2 young people one actually was on the team last year and up until this past spring and transferred. But, you know, the guys, they know one another as far as that concerned, was shot. One of the guys on the team presently was shot, and the younger brother of another player on the team was shot multiple times, that from my understanding from the hospital and news, at least six times. All of them were still alive. All of them were still alive. And but unfortunately, with the advent of our uninterest or unableness to ascend to have an understanding of the system of racism and white supremacy, things are not going to stay the same. They're going to get worse for the victims of this pestilence. And that's just the report that I have so far from this week. Thank you.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Greetings, guests, and to the rest of the callers. So I recently remembered that something I saw on social media that said it said that what did it say? I'm sorry about that. It said that every month in the United States, on average, 111 people that are black are shot by the law enforcement. But in England, only 52 people were killed by the police in the last 50 years. And that was very significant to me because it shows that in the United States, you can get a black person get killed over anything, walking with a cup of iced tea, getting pulled over for a parking fee or a parking ticket or tagged license plates. But in England, that must have been for 52 people in the last 52 years, in the last 50 years, that must have been some significant stuff. For example, homicide or burning down a building or something, that must have been real significant for it to be 52 people in the last 50 years. And I found that very significant, and that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for taking my call.
Appreciate that. Great observation. I would just say quickly, we have talked about that when we've had some of our listeners from England on the program. They have a significantly lower population of black people in that part of the world. And we've talked about before, it is a global system of white supremacy, but things are radically different geographically, depending on how many dark people are in that part of the world, where it's going to be much more severe in terms of the policing and laws that they have. It's going to be much more punitive, much more violent police enforcement officer response if you have a higher population of black people. And I'd be willing to wager that there are probably a disproportionate representation of dark people in that 50 or 52, the number of black people that have been, or the number of people that have been shot by police in England over the last 50 years. I would wager it's probably disproportionately dark, that list. Other folks?
Greg Hurd.
Heard two different folks.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is this is Ken Steele from Chicago. Today, by way of Orange County, California. And, wait just a second here. Okay. I am just going to report this week a few thoughts. Earlier, you played a clip from Congressman Roger Pittenger, who recently got into some, trouble or minor trouble for his suggesting that the black people of North Carolina or South Carolina were protesting because they were not as successful as white people. And, you know, I thought it was very interesting that they were able to completely deflect away from a conversation about law enforcement and begin to start going into a stat-based deflection. And a lot of non-white people I've observed get caught up in having statistical arguments with suspected white supremacists. And also, it seems to be that in these discussions, it seems to be emotionally based. Even though that it's framed in the context of we are going to use mathematics and so-called facts to go ahead and justify the points that we're making. It's all about feelings, including you can observe when Don Lemon makes mentions that many African Americans felt negatively about some of the stats that you are saying. And another aspect of the deflection that Roger Pittenger displayed was that it seems to be something that I've observed, I think, after it really started going into effect after the killing of Trayvon Martin. A new deflection that I've heard white supremacists use is that they will go ahead and acknowledge white supremacy, or the existence of racism, but they will always, always, always say specific instances are not racist. In this case, the stat deflection was basically couched in, and it was suggesting that these statistical realities that African Americans face is somehow not the result of racist policies that are enacted by politicians like Roger Pittenger himself. And the conversation never, ever, ever, ever went in that direction. So I have to say it was a very effective deflection job from Roger Pittenger. Don Lemon did a very poor job of interviewing him, in my estimation, simply because all of his responses seemed to be emotional. They seemed to stray away from the fact that a man was killed unjustly by law enforcement officers. And the conversation, I think it falls in the realm of tacky and both terroristic at the same time. Now, also, I wanted to mention that I am in Orange County currently, and I was recently in the community known as Laguna Beach. I'm sure a number of you guys are familiar with this community. It's been on television shows. And I was at this restaurant, I think it was called The Cliff. While I was at The Cliff, just a second here. While I was at this restaurant called The Cliff, I overheard multiple conversations going on at different tables around me. And the white people that were there, I heard the words Civil War mentioned in context of what's going on right now or the current time. I heard that term being used a lot. And I also heard people openly talking about their plans and their preparation plans. And this was at two separate tables. So this is something that I'm seeing here, that they're getting very brazen with the public executions. And I'm suspecting that there may be, we're coming into the realm of a final solution. And I say that because it seems to me that these people are ramping up their efforts to terminate the lives of non-white people in multiple ways, and they are increasingly less remorseful, or they are no longer holding back their words. They're no longer codifying their speech, and they're no longer trying to hide their hateful neglect of these issues and their hateful feelings of these issues. So this is just something that I am noticing. These people are preparing for something. They are in more of a know than I suspect any of us here. And those conversations just left me feeling, and the recent occurrences going on across the country have left me kind of very nervous about this. And also, I wanted to mention that speaking of the law enforcement officer that shot in Tulsa, if anybody noticed, she looked had a striking resemblance to presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. And I think that there needs to be a greater effort amongst non-white people to recognize that people who look like they ought to be baking cookies or they ought to be a substitute teacher or they ought to be handing out Werther's candies to little children, that some of these people are the most virulent, vicious, and dangerous white supremacists that are operating. And also, I just wanted to mention that you mentioned Charles M. Blow. He's another non-white person that is employed or I see frequently on CNN. Like Don Lemon, I suspect that Charles M. Blow may be a homosexual just by the mannerisms that he is displaying on the air in reaction to this Donald Trump situation. He is frequently emotional in the points that he is trying to make. I saw him having a conversation with another non-white person regarding Donald Trump, and all of the points that Donald Trump made and his surrogate made seemed to get him flustered. He could not explain or articulate a reason to vote for Hillary Clinton, and he resorted to suggesting that Hillary Clinton, a vote for, against Hillary Clinton was a vote to harm non-white people, harm black people, and then he continued to excoriate the people that were voting for alternative candidates or abstaining to vote. So this is somebody that I suspect in this manner may have some something else at stake that he is advocating for. He may have some financial relationship with the Clinton organization. So I'm not sure if his opinions on this matter are unbiased and ought to be taken seriously. And with that, I guess I'll go ahead and mute my line. Thank you.
Sure. Thomas in New York, if you're there, just wanted to get on the record. Mr. Charles Blow, he has publicly identified as being quote-unquote bisexual. And he has written about this in his biography, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. I think it came out in 2014, but he has written essays about this, and he talks at length about it in his book, some of his sexual identification. Thomas in New York, did you have commentary?
Oh, yes, I do. Very interesting commentary, because I've noticed that same trend amongst whites in New York. Talking about a so-called, they're trying to start a race war in reference to Black Lives Matter as early as yesterday. And I found it to be very interesting that they really think Black Lives Matter have that much power, or are they just playing their role as white supremacists? Also, in England, guns are illegal. In fact, I believe most cops don't carry a gun on, or at least they didn't up until recently, probably since this terror thing, but that could account for the reason why they don't have so many police shootings. However, if you count the police brutality, I'm sure that it'll be astronomical. They're experts with their clubs, their nigger knockers. I can't explain why Minnesota and St. Paul, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and the suburbs around them have such a large population of Somalis. That's just found it very interesting, something I found out this week as I was looking into the story from that area. And, you know, I remember when the U.S. went to meet Mogadishu. I believe they did a movie about it, Black Hawk Down. But my cousin in particular was a soldier just marching in, and he told me that the Somalis would spit in the black soldiers' face and call them nigger. Exclusively the black soldiers, didn't do it to the white soldiers. I found it very interesting that Kyle, the correctional officer, wanted to put the dreadlocks on his motorcycle as trophies. White people love to have trophies, even though he sounded like he was a Latino. But just some of those things that rub off, I guess. The Young Turks interview, the racist white female, that they get treated like slaves. Then she went on to talk about them working for free. But that's slavery. That's not slave treatment. I mean, if you're in jail working for free, you're a slave. You're not being treated like a slave. You are one. So I think that was inaccurate. She should have just called it slavery. I was watching the Black Lives Matter protest in North Carolina as it's being coined, the uprising, the so-called riots. I saw a bunch of Mexicans marching with the Mexican flag and a bunch of white people, of course. So I don't know if that's a good idea. Two people definitely not aligned with our gender at all. The guy said, well, it's because of the welfare. I mean, that's just shit, you know, white people, man. Their rhetoric. You know, Charlotte's a very important city, though. It's the headquarters of Bank of America, which was once called the Bank of the Confederacy, for all things. And the mayor, you know, I heard a lot of black people should vote. Obama talked about his legacy. The mayor of Charlotte is a Democrat, so I'm sure black people exclusively voted for her because we don't vote any other way. And her chief of police is black. And if you ask me, she's a racist. She's playing a game. She's making it seem like she wants this tape released, and the chief is coming out saying he doesn't want it released. But as far as I know, the chief works for the mayor. The mayor hires the chief, puts him in place, and he has to do what she says to do. So if the tape had to be released, she would just say release the tape, and that's what would have to be done. So I just find her being very deceptive in that. Also, you know, with the voting, Trump is claiming now he's getting 25% of the black vote. I don't know if that's true, but I would say the fact that we're seeing all these people coming out, you know, telling black people exclusively they need to vote, you know, vote for Hillary, don't mess up my legacy, would say that she feels that the black vote is definitely not supporting her as much. And in the swing states of Ohio, Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Columbus, they need huge turnouts for blacks to win that. And Pennsylvania, they need a huge turnout in Philly. And in Florida, they need a huge turnout in the Miami area and in Jacksonville area. So, you know, to at least if this is all true and real and, you know, this isn't some selective process, she has big problems. But she can't get a huge turnout in those states. So I think that's why we're seeing these black people coming out right now. I think that whites are refining their rhetoric. The new narrative is blacks had it good before Obama. You know, I find it to be disgusting. I think in one way it's deceptively honest because what they're trying to say, and this is what I take from it, is if it wasn't for Obama, we wouldn't have come down so hard on y'all the last 8 years. I think that's what they're really trying to say, but they're curbing it. You know, I'm saying it in a way that makes it sound a little bit more politically correct. But I would say, since Obama, they've stepped up their white supremacy big time. I can't explain it all the way. Anthony Weiner, sexting underage girls. You know, white culture is pedophilia. Those two things are synonymous, as well as rape. Ross said some interesting articles about Epstein, the Jewish millionaire here in New York, and he was charged with having sex with underage girls. But in the articles, you know, he had an alley where he would fly out dignitaries and millionaires like Bill Clinton and Donald Trump to have sex with minors. And it's just a part of how they function. That's their culture. And just keep that in mind. Another part, and I'll end on this, Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, the abduction couple, they woke up, and now they're claiming that he's abusing the kids. In particular, I look at, you know, I think their coach is pedophilia, and Brad Pitt, I look at him, and I can see him being a pedophile. And I noticed that little black girl is getting a little older now. Maybe Mr. Pitt did something with her. Who knows? But we'll never hear the whole story because these are white kids and they're not going to be as forthcoming. But I'm sure that based off of their relationship with black women and black kids and pedophilia, you could just imagine what type of stuff he was doing to these non-white kids. And I'll get my line for now. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. First, let me just say hello to you, just hello to all the callers and listeners that's on this talk tonight. Hopefully, you're doing okay on the plantation. Just to piggyback on something that Thomas of New York just said about, you know, white people in the culture, because, and I do agree, the pedophile, even the rape, because, you know, we're seeing the, well, what would look like the uptick, but it's the stuff out there, guys being charged and arrested for rape, white guys, and getting literally slapped on their wrists, you know, 30 days in jail, 90 days in jail, you know, and I guess when they come out, because I really don't get deep into those cases, so I guess they, you know, it hit them like with a 10-year probation, you know, but, you know, and, you know, with this talk of, well, gosh, you know, their career really can't be destroyed because, you know, they raped a woman. And, you know, even like you say, with the children. So it's just that it's just a part of their culture. So I just wanted to say that. As far as President Obama's CBC meeting, now last Saturday, that was at that dinner. And I, at the time it was going on, I was listening to the cows, but I was looking at my tablet, and I think it was Ayanna Barzan. She had put up like a video showing him he was speaking. And so I'm listening. I got my earplugs in my ears listening to you all, but I was looking at the video, and he was pounding on the podium and stuff. I thought, ooh, you know, he's telling them. And I don't know why, when I listened, but it just kind of reminded me when he went to the NAACP meeting that year. Remember, he told them, put on your marching boots and stuff? You know, and I just kind of chuckled. So the next day when I heard what he said, I was like, you know, and basically, you know, basically putting it on the back for black people. If you want my legacy to stand, you all need to go out there and vote. And like you said, it is vote for Hillary. Now, I'm not going to vote for Hillary. I can't stand her. I mean, it goes back to when her husband was the president. So I'm not going to vote for her. Now, I said I'm going to vote for Donald Trump, but I know I'm not going to vote for Hillary. Here's my thing, though, because just listening to the letter that, or the article that you read with Charles Blow said, and it, you know, somewhere you get this, you know, almost like you're just so dumb, you know, so we got to write this stuff because you're so dumb. You know, when I think about it, and when Hillary Clinton, you know, was running around pushing that crime program of her husband and talking about their super predators, you know, who was she talking about? She was talking about the millennials. Because, you know, he was the president from, what, 1990 or 92 to 80. And the millennials time is, I think, born in between 1980 and 2000. So, you know, I'm sitting around like, because I can look at this, the millennials are the ones that she is saying that they were saying were the super predators. And so now, you know, here you come trying to vote. Now you're basically telling these super predators that, well, she apologized for that. And, you know, you all shouldn't, you know, I mean, she apologized for that. How dare you hold her? Check it out. Now, you ask her, I'm not a millennial, but I'm a baby boomer. But you're asking, when I say us, I mean black people, you're asking us to vote for her. However, she said her, you know, she said, very unpleasant, I'm just trying to be nice right there, very unpleasant things about black people. And then you got other black people saying, well, she's apologized for that. Just forgive her and vote for her. You know, and I'm just like, you know, the millennials, the ones that she was running around here talking about are the super predators, or the millennials today that she needs their vote. So, you know, to me, that's just something that they need to think of as they come out to write their articles, chastise people, you know, for having the nerve, and literally, to me, it comes out that you, here you are, you have the nerve to say that. You're not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. You know, you're going to vote for Donald Trump, or you're going to vote for Jill Stein, or you're going to vote for the other gentleman, Gary, whatever his name is, or you're going to vote for, you know, somebody else, but you just have the nerve to say, you have the nerve to reason and read up and study the candidates and then make your decision. You have the nerve to do that. How do you think you have the nerve to do that? You just need to be supporting Hillary Clinton because we have to save President Obama's legacy. I'm like, go talk to Brad about that. But I just wanted to point that out. And I mean, I might be wrong. If I am, please correct me. But I do think that the millennials are the super predators, the people that she, they deem the super predators. And I just kind of, I'm kind of taken aback by that article that Charles wrote. I just think it's very arrogant and really, very disrespectful. Because the millennials can think and they can read and they can research and they can look at each candidate and they have the right to make their decision and vote for who they want to. And I will say this too, I do agree with you, Gus, when you said, hey, if you got to have somebody in the House, then let's just have the open races in the White House. I don't need to have somebody, because the way I look at it, Trump and Clinton are basically two peas in the same pot. All of them are, in my opinion, out there. Gary, Jill Stein, they're just all bad candidates. This election here is probably, in my lifetime, and it's probably some of the worst candidates we could have. I may be wrong in that. But, I'm just shocked. But I do agree with you. Hey, if I got to have them, let me have the open races, because the way I look at it, the stuff that Trump is saying out in public is the same mess that Clinton is saying behind closed doors. And then I'm going to say this and I'm out. I'm looking at how this is going. And so now remember, Donald Trump has already put out in the air that it's rigged. We do know in the history of this country, you've had men, and it's been men, who have won the popular vote and lost the electoral vote. I think what Hillary is doing is they're counting electoral votes. It just seems like to me she's not. We hear a lot about Donald Trump. I don't hear a lot about Hillary out in her politics. So to me, it's just like they're just counting electoral votes, and it's just like if we can get this many votes to win the electoral, we got it. And I just wanted to put that out there. But anyway, thank you, Naomi.
Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free.
Hey, Gus, can I just say that the reporter just said the last part is predators that need to come to heel, or whatever that means. And I think that's important to add that last part in here as well.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to all the other callers and listeners. I wanted to start off first just by giving a rest in peace to Bill Nunn. He was known as Radio Raheem and Do the Right Thing. He died today. That just came out not too long ago, so I just wanted to say that first. In reference to the clips, I found it very telling that President Obama was talking about to study history to find out that our votes matter. And I just said, hey, from studying history, I know my vote doesn't matter. That's why I don't really, give two hoots about the presidential election whatsoever. Local elections, definitely you can make a difference in some of the things that are happening to you locally as far as the way politics run. So that is something I believe is very important. But as far as the presidency, that is the biggest farce and joke ever. So he'll just have to be offended, and I really could care less about him being offended anyway. His entire presidency is offensive to me. I was going to say I found it interesting that when he said that his legacy was tied up with the election of President Clinton, I just find that to be just disgusting, simply because when he ran against her to get into office, she was so racist and just tacky, trashy, and trifling towards him. So to me, it's just such a nauseating thing to see him now stumping for her and going throughout the country telling black people to vote when, she mistreated him so severely when he was making his bid for the office. And I just don't understand that, but that's the psychology of white supremacy as far as how black people have been trained to behave. We, whether consciously or subconsciously, understand the power dynamic, and he's just falling in line with that power dynamic. It's almost like he's identifying himself with Clinton and her being elected. it's just disgusting, actually. It kind of reminds me of when Mr. Malcolm talks about the Massa-We-Sick syndrome. And then I saw an image of his wife hugging one, President Bush, today at the opening ceremony of the African-American History and Culture Museum, which was nauseating as well because George Bush was just so racist towards her husband, but she's, you know, just skinning and grinning and, you know, hugging on him and they're taking pictures. I just found that to be nauseating. I thought about the entire African-American History Museum. I think that it's a good thing just to have, I guess, a central place where our history, some of our history can be found and discerned. But I think that anything that's given to black people by white people, including that museum, is something that is racist, white supremacist. And there's the other part about it is just the name of the museum being called the African American History Museum. I think it just reinforces this false notion that the black people who were enslaved in this country, who were brought here all on slave ships, and that there isn't any indigenous legacy of Africans and black people in this country, which there is, that goes back long before. And beyond that, just the fact that there were very few people brought to North America in particular from the African continent. So I think that just is an act of white supremacy in reinforcing these false truths. Also, in regards to the shooting of Keith Lamont, I just found that to be just disgusting. I saw a clip of two witnesses, eyewitnesses from the neighborhood, who one was black, the other one was an overweight white woman, and both of them said the same thing. The white woman seemed to have known him even better than the black female. But both of them basically said that he was sitting in his vehicle waiting for his son like he did every day, reading a book. The white woman, actually, I guess she had some sort of contact with him. She seemed to have known him a little bit better, and that he did not have a gun at all, and that they were trying to blame the black officer for shooting and killing this black male, when in reality it was a white cop that actually killed him. And the footage actually shows the same thing, but yet the news was reporting in some cases that it was the black cop that actually killed him, and it was not. And I just think those two witnesses, especially the black female, need to be very careful because, you know, police will kill you, you know, to shut you up so that you don't end up, you know, going further with telling the truth. But they're already captured on camera, basically both of them saying exactly the same thing in regards to how that situation went down. The other situation with Mr. Crutcher, I mean, this is just, it's like these people are just killing us like they squash roaches and stuff. It's just horrible. And, they're using Black Lives Matter to indicate that, you know, black people are going to go into this race war. And if you look at, just go to the website, read what Black Lives Matter is all about. It's really all about propagating LGBTQ issues over anything really seriously affecting the killings of black people. I think some of the people in that group definitely have those feelings. But if you just look at their, I guess you can call it their mission statement on the main page of their website, they basically are focusing on anti-sexual issues relating to black people. And I think that just further, you know, propagates that genocidal tactic that white people have inculcated us with for more of us to indulge in, essentially. And for now, with that, I'll mute my line and thank you for taking my call.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Cassie's Karma. I've had technical difficulties, so thank everyone for their patience these last few weeks. The race war thing. The adolescent came home from school, and he said, well, if Donald Trump gets elected, and I always listen to him. I listen to him because I know that the white children are not as codified as their parents. So they listen to what their parents are saying, and then they bring that back to school and feed that to the black children. So he said, the white children are saying, well, if Donald Trump gets elected, he's going to be assassinated. And it's black people who are going to assassinate him. So I guess this is something that the white community is planning on, assassinating Mr. Trump as they have assassinated other people, and they're planning on blaming it on black people. That's what I got out of that. And I'm I'm a little bit behind on some things. So, you know, with all of the white police officers, with all the enforcement officials shooting and killing black people, and you listen to them and they say, well, you know, in the heat of the moment, you know, you can't tell. It's just, you know, you're really tense. You know, the adrenaline's pumping, and that's why you shoot 47 times, and blah, 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 blah. And then everybody says, yes, white people are terrified of black people, and they're really afraid, and that's why the adrenaline's flowing, blah, 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 blah. So what I'm saying, you know, in the past, you know, I've worked emergency services, and I've been around, you know, in hospital situations, you know, where people are running around with guns and seeing what they can do for the area. And people have, you know, been dying and dying collectively. And I never had an adrenaline-fueled hallucination. I never, you know, because of all the adrenaline, hallucinated that a book was a gun, or that a 12-year-old child was a man, or that someone who was falling and dying was actually charging. I've never had an adrenaline-fueled hallucination in my life. So my conclusion is, they're just lying. They're lying. They are not jazzed up. It's not that they're overwhelmed. It's not like, bang, 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 we're shooting 47 times because, you know, we're just so wired up with the situation being so dangerous and everything. No. No. They're just flat out lying. They are murdering people. No provocation. It is a huge lie. It has nothing to do with a threat or danger or hallucination. So that's my conclusion. I don't know. Maybe I'm the last person to get it, but I get that these people are all lying when they say they feared for their life. There was no fear involved. There was no adrenaline hallucination, nothing. So I'm done with that, thinking about it. And the last thing is a little bit separate, but no one's talking about it. I mean, is anybody talking about that commercial with the two albino people who are retiring early, and both of them have that pheomelanin coloring, and it's with Chase Bank, and they've got, and I mean, all of the things in it make me so uncomfortable. And I, if you allow me a moment, it's just like Chase, the last big commercial they had was the same albino guy with the same coloring, and he was dressing up like a fairy princess. And here's this guy. He's got on these pink pants with this mauve jacket, and they have a pig for a pet. They have their pet is the same animal that they eat. And I just can't believe that no one is looking at that. And then plus they've got Shaggy singing Lover Lover. So, I mean, I don't know how to interpret that commercial, but it made me really tense. I couldn't figure out what they were trying to say, but the whole thing made me uneasy. And I just wondered if anyone else had that feeling. Thank you.
I haven't seen that commercial, so I can't comment. But if anyone has, feel free. Karma would appreciate your feedback. I'll post it on my Facebook page so that people can view it once I track it down. Anybody that we have not heard from at all? Anyone that we have not heard? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you. Greetings to all the callers. Greetings, Gus. Another great broadcast. Couple things. First, I'll start off with President Obama and his comments that he made to the CBC. It's just it's funny because my lady companion actually has the same feelings in reference to voting for reason for not voting for Trump, and her comments to me was, look, we can't do this. You know, white people will just walk up to us and just spit on us like they did in the 60s and 70s. And I listen to this show more than she does, and I do a lot more reading, so I just know that she has the same feeling for a lot of non-white females and males in reference to they do not view Hillary Clinton as a suspected racist, particularly because of her association with Barack Obama. The other thing that I noticed in reference to Mr. Obama's speech today, and it was a Dr. Welsing moment, was that it's he said a lot of things about, you know, this museum is going to create a lot of dialogue about, and I don't think he used racism, white supremacy at all, but about, you know, discrimination issues and matters. And he just kept using the word dialogue. I've seen that word dialogue used a lot in just talking about possibly how us just having conversations are going to end this problem. And that's obvious that it's not. Another thing that I saw online in reference to the museum today was there was a woman that had already previewed the museum, and I think that this goes back to kind of what Roger said, and she had said that after 30 minutes, she was crying and she was nauseous. And from what I believe, just based on some of the comments that were on that post, were that there's so much pain there. And I believe that I just believe that the white supremacists literally built this to just remind black people of, hey, now we have a huge architecture to show you exactly how we mistreated you from the beginning to now. And that just kind of bothered me. In reference to, I believe, the congressman's comments about North Carolina, that is that his comments were obviously, he's probably a racist, but is a racist, but in reference to the poverty that is there, I have real estate dealings in the Greensboro Triad area, and my father and I were looking at properties that his brother had passed away had left a lot. And so we're thinking about buying the lot, and I called the Guilford County office, and the lady says, oh, if you want other lots, you know, just go to the website and look at it. And, you know, we have property for sale there. And so I look at the website, and I call my dad, and I say, Dad, they have 912 properties in this area that are up for foreclosure, and the majority of those areas where non-white people live. And so the only thing I think of is I just always go back to referencing this show. The reason why those black people are losing their homes is not because they weren't working. It's because of racism, white supremacy. And then one other thing about Mr. Obama that I'm in my mind, and it's not being condescending towards him, but another thing that I've noticed that I think the white supremacists are doing pretty well is they've really made him seem like this very cool, calm, collected president. I saw that he did another article on Vanity Fair, and in that article, I was looking for the link so I can forward it to you guys, but he's talking about specifically the things he's going to do after his presidency is over and some of the things he couldn't speak on. And I could be wrong, but I just don't remember a president doing this many interviews for non-serious magazines. It's almost like now it's like the American public views him as a joke. He's just this cool black guy that has Kendrick Lamar and rappers coming to the White House, and, oh, while that's happening, we're just going to keep shooting you guys. And I just found that very disturbing. And I know he's a victim, but I just see how the white supremacists are just using his whole image and everything that's going around us. And it's just very, very bothersome. And I'll mute my line, and thanks for taking my call, guys.
Appreciate that.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus, and the audience. This show, love what I'm hearing. I just want to say a couple of things for me, and I appreciate the gentleman that just came on right before me because he helped me to quell my energy that kind of flares up here once in a while. I would say for me, if I had to respond to this thing, this speech, I'm going to say the first thing, and I hope it's being respectful, understanding that our president is a victim. I would say I took his speech as a act of racism, white supremacy. That's just how I feel about it. I also am disappointed that the president would take a job or a campaign for a job that, you know, if this was any common man having to apply for a job, that person would have to put down their job qualifications, and before you sought out this job, you would have to know what the duties entail. So to take this job on and not to do what his roles and tasks and duties were supposed to be is an offense, in my opinion, to everybody. Even if it meant your life being put on the line. I understand, or at least I've come to the conclusion that every day our president probably wakes up being put in a position where his family is used as ransom against him to deliver these speeches. So I have to be, you know, sympathetic to his situation. But I just can't respect the fact that he has that position and won't act the role out 100%. And if that meant taking a stand, then that's where he should be. I also don't understand how the legacy is insulted if we don't vote when the Tea Party did a nice job destroying that legacy. And I feel as though he should always remind himself that they made sure to tell him the first term that they wanted him to only be a one-term president. And I think this gets overlooked too often. I think this separation of generations by calling ourselves millennials and Generation X and all of that is absurd, because there is nothing that separates us other than some of us recognize, some of us recognize but choose to take the other side. That's been going on since we have been all part of the stage show. I believe that, you know, right now there's too much distraction going on because we're not focused on something that's very serious here, and it's the imprisonment slavery industry. And what I mean by that is I myself recently come to understand that when everybody's talking about building a wall, I can tell you, in my opinion, they already have a wall built, and it's called patriotic white men with AKs and AR-15s that guard that border, and they kill them people down there, and it's not being reported. So that's a wall that's already been standing. The slavery that I feel, you know, I support and feel like Scottie Reed them are saying is because we're missing the point that when they can hire people in the prison to work for 0 cent or 10 cent an hour or a day, and then that same job is supposed to be marketed to the free world, why would they want to hire somebody for $10 an hour when they got somebody in the prison working for nothing? So our energies are really backwards. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, I just want to make sure we... Oh, yes, ma'am, go ahead. Are you there, ma'am? I heard you. Are you there?
Oh, okay. I thought somebody else might have spoken. This is the caller from New Orleans. I was just calling in. Basically, as far as the week's events, I haven't seen any of the videos of these police killings, and I just continue my boycott of looking at them anymore, because, like I said, it's between being traumatized visually and then seeing the same old responses being played out by the families of these tragedies, and that's pretty much that on that issue. I did see a bit of the speech and the ceremony for the new museum. I just think, really, honestly, it's just a watered down version of what our history is supposed to represent. But like some of the other callers said, you know, if it's coming from white people and in this day and age with all of the stuff that's going on in this country, I just take it with a grain of salt. And I do believe that as Obama's presidency, is about to wind down, you know, it just only helps embolden, you know, white people to show their true colors. My dad was telling me just the other day. He was at, because he works at the Federal City here in Louisiana at the Marine Corps Center, and he said that he had overheard a conversation with a commander as he was going in to work on some equipment in there. And basically the person was talking about, I guess, whatever the rioting and stuff was going on in North Carolina after the shooting, and basically had made a comment saying he used some type of racial slur. I can't remember. I'd have to ask him again. And but basically he said that his friend, which is, I guess, is a black female. I don't know whether he's really talking to her or not. But anyway, but she had sent him a video that I had shared on my timeline from his phone. But he said he was talking to me about how to, you know, counter some of the stuff that how he and his other black employees have been countering some of the stuff. I guess they've gotten emboldened to just come out with how they believe as far as, you know, in relation to white supremacy. So my dad was saying that he had pulled up a couple of videos on black history and showed it to one of the guys and was like, you know, kind of did the reverse thing of what most white people do to us on a day-to-day basis, you know, trying to ask for our opinions on issues about race and stuff like that. So he kind of flipped the script and did the same thing and kind of put the guy on blast and was just like, you know, he was telling me that, you know, that may be something that I want to do, which is, you know, but I just think that as far as for most black people, we really shouldn't be wasting too much time trying to convince white people of their terrorism and pathology. So I don't know if people want to invest that much time in actually getting in any type of dialogue with them at this point, because I think even the most uneducated white person knows exactly what their standing is in regards to the system. So I really just don't see a point, you know, of us trying to engage in any type of dialogue or discussions or talks about, you know, why we feel the way we feel. I think they're very much aware of what they're doing and, you know, what this system is about. So, and I think that's it. Other than, like I said, I don't want to support any more black organizations or either speak for them on anything in regards to what's going on, because I just see a pattern with us as far as, you know, acting emotional about things, and then after a few months it fizzles out until something else happens, and it's just, it's kind of draining. So if I see, you know, protesters, you know, alongside white people, I'm not going to support it, justify it, because it's, at this point, we just have to make a decision whether or not we're going to be engaged with white people on that level. And if we still feel that we have to have white allies in regards to our struggles, then we're in a lot of trouble. So I'll meet my line.
Indeed. Did we miss anybody? Anybody that we have not heard from at all have commentary that wanted to make sure they get in? Incidentally, I did see, I think the New York Times, they reported that they are going to release the video footage in the Charlotte shooting with Keith Scott. Did see that today before we went on air, that they are going to release it. I don't know. It may have been released already since we have been broadcasting. But again, I do not watch any of this
footage. I haven't watched any of the footage that's been released to it already. Just, I think that's another element of the terrorism. They might, you could probably stack reels and reels and reels of that in the new museum of black people being bludgeoned and terrorized by enforcement officials. But I did see that before we went on the air. Anybody that we've missed? Anybody we've not heard from at all?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Greetings to the host, the listeners, and callers. It was a very interesting part in the audio segment. I think this may have been a teacher that said something about, I think like she asked her students about how did they feel about, I guess, the recent shootings. And she said that, or it may have been a he, said that they responded by asking a question like, you know, like, why did this happen? And, you know, why does this keep happening and what's going on? I thought that was very interesting. If that was the dynamic that took place. And I was thinking about the, I think the guy name was Trent Dilfer that made the comments about Colin Kaepernick. And he said that, well, I'm sure people have heard it, but what I noticed, like, I guess he used some kind of a metaphor or anti-black language where he said he's just a backup quarterback that should go sit in the shadows. So, you know, I thought that was very interesting because, you know, you go to a football game, you know, it's heavily lit, lights all over the stadium. So, you know, he had to use that term shadows to insult a non-white person. And there was a few articles that I had seen. There was one where I think it was at American University. They were having some protest about, I guess, some students have bananas thrown at them, or a student had a banana thrown at them, and it was a banana put in front of someone's dorm room. And, you know, of course, that's definitely symbolic of racism. And it was another high school where I think it was in Atlanta where they staged a sit-in in the cafeteria, and they said they were going to wear all black on Friday and call it Blackout Day. Like, they didn't really, like, define what that meant, you know. So I guess it was in response to a Twitter post about it being too many black people, you know, in this high school. I think it's Gwinnett High School. And, like, it looked like it was a couple of white people in the sit-in from the video they showed. Like, they was raising their fists. I guess, you know, it came from that influence of the Kaepernick protests. So, you know, they were raising their fists and, I guess, in protest about racism. And one last article that I had seen was down here in Ocala, Florida. There was this suspected race soldier, police chief, who was, I guess, he was suspended with pay. And from my understanding, the meeting or the hearings they had the mayor. The mayor was definitely in support of this person, saying that, you know, well, you know, the whole community likes him and things like that. And, you know, we're just going to have to wait until all of this plays out. And there were allegations about, I guess, sexual harassment and retaliation and, I guess, discrimination. Like, those are the terms that were used. And it's a white woman that's the attorney for the three victims. And I think one of them is a black male. And it was two other female names. They didn't name classification, so I couldn't determine whether they were white or not. And I think they said it was a 12-page grievance letter. But what was interesting was that they said they voted 4-1 to agree with the police chief's, I guess, some kind of request to be suspended with pay, you know, until all this controversy ends. So I guess it was 4 or 5 people sitting on the board. So they ended up pretty much granting his request. And I guess as he's being suspended, you know, racial showcase, and of course, they replaced his spot with a black male. So I think that could have definitely been a move of deception to make it seem like, you know, that they don't practice racism. And what they also did in the clip was they interviewed the black female that was on the board, and she was the only one that said, she said, no, this guy needs to be suspended, you know, with what we already had drawn up. You know, I didn't know what that meant. I guess they had some kind of plan, like they came up with before, and I guess they just, you know, pretty much pushed that to the side and said, you know what, we'll just vote to have them suspended with pay. So I found that interesting, and that's pretty much all I have right now. Thank you.
Fascinating. Don't want to be too hard on whites, regardless of what their transgression is. If folks are interested, I posted the report he was talking about with the students at Gwinnett High School, where you can check out the incident and the protest and all of that. It's on my Facebook page if you are so interested. I forgot, I should be paying more attention to ball games, I guess. Colin Kaepernick and the 49ers will be here tomorrow playing the Seahawks. They have been talking about the protest and all of that because some of the Seahawks players this week were talking about the shooting in Charlotte, and I think Richard Sherman came out and was saying that this is unacceptable. I don't think he used the term racism, but he and some of the other players have been talking about it. So that will be the item of the day, to see who does what during the national anthem. Even I know some of the Seahawks players had been sitting during or kneeling during the anthem previously as well. So it will be interesting to see how all of that unfolds up here in the Great Northwest tomorrow. Anybody that we missed? Anybody that we did not get to hear from at all? Grand. I think we got everybody. We have about 10 minutes left, so please no stragglers. If you have something to say, you should get up. If you already spoken, that's fine. If folks had anything they wanted to make sure that they get in before we conclude, feel free.
Guys, I don't know if you... Oh, that Thomas, I'll go after you.
Oh, thank you, Rob. I just want to say I saw the tape of the tape that the wife shot of the shooting in North Carolina, and as you couldn't tell if he had a book or a gun, but what stood out was the picture that the still shot that they keep showing with the gun on the scene is not in that video, and that video was taken from that same exact angle. So there definitely needs to be an investigation on where did that gun just pop up next to the victim at. And also, I found, and I'm not sure if this is what's going to happen in this case, usually when white people withhold the tape, it's not because they're hot or something. It's usually they got something even more incriminating. Like, I think of the Mike Brown thing, and all of a sudden, the strong arm robbery tape comes out. You know, it's like, wait a few days for information to be released, and the information they release is always more incriminating. So I wouldn't be too suspicious if the tape doesn't have proof that he might have a weapon or what, because that's generally the pattern they follow. They'll let all the chaos in the suit, and then they'll come out with something that makes it look like, look, y'all did it for nothing. I'm in my life.
I wanted to say, in reference to the shooting as well, with the interview, I remember the white female had talked about, and the black female both talked about the fact that when he got out the car, he got out with both of his hands up and asked the officers what he did wrong. And when he got out, the book fell out of his lap because he had put the book in his lap and put his hands up. So as he was getting out, the book fell on the floor. And the white female said that when she tried to get closer, to just see things a little bit better, because she said that when the police, after they shot him, they had looked, they were searching the vehicle, and they put their bodies in a position where they were blocking her view, and she believes that that's when they planted the gun, because he did not have a gun, simply because she saw him every day. She said she indicated that she had spoken to him before, so they're acquainted with one another, and that he was there waiting for his son like he did every day.
They discussed that the book fell when he stood up because it was in his lap, and that the police, they asked her, was she able to see when they was searching the vehicle? She said no. As she got closer, a cop threatened to shoot her. He said, if you come any closer, I'm going to shoot you. And I believe both of the females actually said that they were threatened to be shot if they came any closer. And they believe that that's when they actually put the gun in the car to say that he actually had a weapon. And that makes sense to me. Why would you go to pick up your son with a weapon in the vehicle? And if you were going to shoot a police officer, why would you go there with a gun, knowing you're there to pick up your child, to go gun down an officer? And, oh, yeah, the white lady also said that his son walked up on everything. So it was right after everything happened. She said that the son actually just got off the bus, and he walked there, and he walked up on his father laid out in the street like that, which is horrific for a young child to see. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Incidentally, yes, sir, just incidentally, North Carolina is an open carry state, so even if Mr. Scott did have a gun, that is not illegal. The person who just spoke up.
Oh, thanks, Gus. Yeah, in reference to there earlier, there was a, when in the clip, the gentleman, I think he was representing the Nation of Islam, and he was speaking, and it sounded like he was making some pretty constructive points. One of the things that he mentioned was, and I don't know if it was him or the reporter mentioned about possibly in Charlotte area, them not having the CIAA tournament, which is a it's a HBCU weekend and a lot of, you know, entertainers, and there's a lot of parties and things of that nature. They need to be very careful about that, because I read an article last year specifically about Charlotte and how they were literally trying to do away with the CIAA tournament, because it brings a lot of non-constructive activity. And basically that's what these white people were saying, that, you know, all these Negroes coming into the town and they get rowdy, somebody gets shot, and things of that nature. So if they are going to think about possibly boycotting and not holding that tournament, they just might want to think about that a little bit, because the city of Charlotte, just like the city of Miami, have been actively trying to get rid of all these events, to where all these non-white people come in there and they have extravaganzas and parties and things of that nature. So that's just an observation that I made, and I mean my life.
This is the same basketball tournament that people remember last year, where one of the, it was a bar, I think might have been connected to a hotel, but they had a Negro surtax, basically, is what it amounted to. If you were a black patron and you came to this establishment, you had to pay a certain amount of money per hour, because they were saying that a lot of the black people affiliated with this tournament, that they would come to their establishment and take up tables and not buy anything, or not buy enough over a certain period of time. So this was their response, and they didn't do this to anybody else and that sort of thing. So I think some of our listeners, Thomas in New York and many others, have said, hey, I am totally down with no more athletics at all, because we certainly have more pressing concerns as black people than running around on a field or a court after a ball. We could, you know, be directing that energy, time and energy, to other things. But I do remember that from last year.
Charlotte already, they already canceled the NBA All-Star game because of the bathroom situation with the LGBT and transvestites or transgenders wanting to use the bathrooms that men go to or women go to. And because the state ruled against it, they moving the All-Star game this year. And, so I don't think that the revenue from this black tournament will have too much of an effect on the economy if they already allowed the All-Star game to be moved.
The All-Star game and the NCAA championship games, as well as the ACC championship games, I think they estimated that that was a loss of $50 million, and it didn't seem that whites were moving to change the law. I think some of the whites in the state did make comments saying that it should be repealed, but thus far nothing has happened. So I cannot imagine this the CIAA tournament bringing in $50 million for the state. So I'm sure they would be, the response would be good riddance to the Negras by moving the tournament. Anybody else? Comments they wanted to make sure they get in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
three things really briefly. I think Thomas New York said something about one of the officers may be a Latino male. I've noticed that at my job there are a lot of white people who have Latino first and last names. And strangely, there's two white males in their mid-40s that has the name Tyrone. Another thing that I wanted to share is on my last therapy session when I talked about how everyone should be working on producing justice. She did agree, but then she keeps reiterating that I can't change the world. So, I mean, I agree with her, but then I also said that there are individuals that made a major impact, such as Marcus Garvey, Martin Luther King, people like that. So I say if everyone works toward producing justice, then that can help. Again, I think I mentioned that she seems to keep trying to push me toward having a good relationship with white people. I told her I'm not interested in having relationships with white people. I just like them to be open and honest about how they feel. And if they really don't like non-white people, then they can just live their lives but not try to cause any confusion or any pain to us. So basically, we were going back and forth, and like I said, she said a few things that was interesting. She said that I should try to hold open doors for them and just try to have conversations. Yeah. That's when I started to withdraw and not tell her too much. I was going to tell her some things about the cows. I think I did mention some things before when we first met, but it seems like the more and more that I meet with her, it seems like she's trying to push me toward like talking to white people and telling them how I feel. But I keep telling her, like, in my opinion, white people know exactly what black people are going through and how they feel. They're causing all the drama. She has mixed feelings. Like I said, she keeps telling me that black people can be racist, and she'll say stuff like, well, a black person might do this, a black person might do that, and or they might call someone else a nigger or mistreat them. And I said, but it's not solely based off their color. So that was basically it that I wanted to share.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Desi. You were going to say something?
No, you can get your comment in, sir.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say, earlier I sent an article to you and Thomas. I don't know if you remember it, but it was about a white doctor who was arrested for raping his patient. Essentially, how it goes is she went into his office for surgery.
Muted.
She was basically drugged up after the surgery. He
unmuted.
This was suspected he had raped other patients. So for some reason, this particular day, they set up a hidden camera in the, I guess, the recovery room. And the woman had family that was there. And after the surgery, he had told the family that he was going to give her a private examination. So the nurses left the room. The family left the room. And the family felt that that was weird, the way he said the whole private examination thing. And the nurses just knew something was off. So after everything was over, they went and reviewed the film footage, and they actually had still shots in the article of him, like, I guess, sticking his tongue in her mouth. Then he groped her, and then finally he mounted her, and they had just had still shots of what happened. And I was just going to say, again, these are the things, and he did it. I believe the woman was either white or she might have been so-called Latino because she was a lighter-skinned woman with brunette hair. There wasn't, like, a close-up, so you couldn't see, like, their features. But the whole thing is, this is the kind of stuff you can expect when we go to them for medical care. You know, we have to be so super careful, especially, you know, black women, because, you know, black women tend to be the ones that they do this to the most as far as being sexually terroristic. you know, please be careful. It's just horrible, but I don't know if you remember the article. I sent it to you earlier today. Rape is white culture alongside racism, and that's actually a great part of racism. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
We will wrap there. We did our 3 hours. We will be here on Monday. I think we will actually be competing with the first presidential debate with Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Monday evening. I don't think they're including Jill Stein and Gary Johnson in that. I could be wrong, but I think they've been excluded from this one. Anywho, I'm sure people will be able to listen to the program and kind of see what's happening with all of that, if anything surprising goes down, to comment on as things are unfolding Monday evening. But our guest is a white man, Marcus Rediker. His book, The Slave Ship, he's actually written quite a few books about the enslavement of black people. This one specifically, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing mentioned it on the program as a book that she had just purchased. She didn't make an endorsement for the book anything. She just mentioned that she was just out in the bookstore, and this was one of the books that she got, encouraging folks to read. And as I was going back in the archives, I remembered the title and invited him on the program. Interestingly, Mr. Rediker was one of the consultants for the Roots reboot, which he information he volunteered when I invited him on the program. So certainly if folks are interested in asking about all of that, that should be something to discuss as well. His book, The Slave Ship, it's don't know the best word to sum it up. It goes into a lot of detail, of course, mentioning how black people were complicit in black people being enslaved and stolen from the continent. But it also gives a lot of gruesome detail about the operations. That's pretty much what it's focused on, and how these ships were constructed and how they operated, and just trying to give a lot of details about what all this was about. But he'll be here on Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The white female I was hoping to get on from Denmark, she was just being white, in my view, practicing racism from the very beginning, and saying that she's not an expert, she's not informed on racism in Denmark. That's what she is, even though she was interviewed by the New York Times to talk about the rising, same thing we've been talking about this program this evening, the rising explicit nature of white supremacy in Denmark. She was interviewed earlier this month, and she was saying that she's not an expert, she's not really informed, there have to be some people that would be better to talk to. And then she said she didn't get enough time to prep because I didn't send her archives for the program, so she doesn't want to do it. I'm trying to see if we can still get that together, because then we would have two programs on Monday, and both with white people, white male, white female. Even if she does not follow through, we have a different white female coming on the program Wednesday, one of our investors, B. Moore. Her sister was posting about the events happening this week in North Carolina and Oklahoma and everything. And this white woman popped in from nowhere. She said that she's disgusted with whites. They're so racist that she just can't deal with it anymore. And she has a lot of stuff on her timeline basically saying this. And B. Moore thought it was noteworthy. She agreed to come on the program to talk about her disgust with whites. I think there's a cowbell on this because I think she is married to a black male. I have to confirm before we get to Wednesday. But that'll be Wednesday, normal program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We have the book club coming up. That's Friday. That will be our third segment, Sam Greenlee, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. We have not got that far. I think we stopped on chapter 9, so you can go in the archives, catch up. Excellent read, and hope folks will be able to share their thoughts, observations, and participate as we go through Mr. Greenlee's work. With that, thanks for everyone tuning in this Saturday evening. We'll be grand to get ready for the programs coming up on Monday. Might be more than one. We'll see. If you have questions, guest suggestions, if you can't find something in the archives, if you just have general comment or question, gripes, complaints, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. I hope everyone is staying as safe as possible. I will state again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. That includes alcohol, cigarettes, anything you want to put in that category. Sobriety would be best. I do not think any of these situations would be better. What happened to Mr. Scott
what happened to Mr. Crutcher, any of the other situations. None of these, I don't think, would be better if a black person, any black person involved there, was under the influence. We want to be lucid, clear thinking, so we can make the best possible decisions to try to keep ourselves as safe as possible. You and anybody that you might be responsible for, things, we are, number one, we are under constant warfare, whites waging war against black people worldwide, non-white people in total. We want to make sure that our behavior reflects that. I mean, it does not take very long. I think folks have been talking about it, for Mr. Scott in North Carolina to be waiting to pick up your child. And bam, you never know when that is the moment that you will bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson. Whites are dangerous, badge or no. That's something that just cannot be understated. We really need to take that seriously and make sure that we are functioning in a manner that reflects the situation that we are in, being constant targets of white terrorism. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.